Good afternoon. We're going to go ahead and get started. I'd like to go ahead and call to order the Senate Interim Committee on Judiciary.
I'm calling the House Interim Committee on Judiciary to order, please.
So thank you for being here. Today we have a pretty full schedule. We're going to be moving through as quickly as we can with the time restraints that we have. I want to thank everyone for being here this afternoon for the presentations. Remember that these are informational hearings with invited testimony. Co-chair Krieger, I was going to say the wrong name. I didn't want to give Barker credit here, since he's probably vacationing.
He is on vacation.
Fact-finding mission.
Public record.
In Arizona,
if I'm not mistaken.
Hawaii, okay. So anyway, what we're going to do is we're going to go through, and I will be chairing the first part of the meeting for the first two topics, and then Representative Krieger will carry on with the other two that we have. So thank you again. So our first one is going to be an informational hearing dealing with the issue of legislation on the sale of marijuana in the state of Oregon. What we're going to do is start off with a presentation from Congressman Earl Blumenauer, who we're fortunate to have him in the building today since he just got back from D.C. yesterday. But I would be remiss to not point out that we do have a new member on our committee. Michael Dimbro, who is now Senator Michael Dimbro, has come over to join us from the House of Representatives with the exiting of Senator Jackie Dingfelder, who is now working for the city of Portland. So Michael, thank you very much for being here, and I hope that you enjoy your experience and time with us on Judiciary. We really look forward to your input and value your expertise and knowledge as what you will bring to the committee, just as other senators have as well.
So thank you, Senator. Appreciate that.
All right, with that, I'd like to go ahead and ask Congressman Blumenauer to please come forward. And Earl, if you have someone else that you wanted with you or anything, I'm not sure if you had any.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I appreciate the courtesy of being able to share some thoughts and observations with you from two perspectives. One, a tiny bit of legislative history, and then a reference to what we are doing on the federal level, which may help in terms of some of your deliberations. I was first involved with this issue 40 years ago this year when, as a freshman member, I listened to...
Congressman Blumenauer, I hate to ask you to do this, but I do need you to put your name on the record.
I'm sorry. My name
How quickly
is Earl
we
Blumenauer.
Forget.
I am a member of Congress from Portland.
Thank you.
Thank you. Now I'm official. See how,
the House,
how quickly
the
they forget.
Now official, so.
How quickly they forget. It was 40 years ago that I had the privilege, as a freshman member of the Legislative Assembly, to hear what I think was perhaps the most single eloquent presentation I have heard in any legislative body with which I've been associated. It was a presentation by a gentleman some of you knew, legendary legislator, public servant, Stafford Hansel, from Hermiston, Oregon, a Republican hog farmer, self-described, who proceeded to explain to the House of Representatives why he was carrying a bill that would legalize two plants for personal consumption. And if any of you knew Stafford, you know he was a very upright, I know he didn't smoke, didn't drink. I never heard him raise his voice or use foul language. But Stafford took us through. This is a cigarette. It kills 400,000 people a year. It's highly addictive. Alcohol. This is a marijuana cigarette, which, to the best of our knowledge, has never killed anybody and is not highly addictive. And he went through this presentation. It was fascinating. 19 people voted for that, but it was part of a process for me. I became convinced, based on not just Stafford's eloquence, but the evidence at that time, that we had a policy that was misdirected. I have shared with each of you a report that I've compiled that just talks of the state of play in terms of marijuana legislation in this country. In 1973, Oregon became the first state that decriminalized marijuana, and I think it's 14 states now that have followed. In 1996, there was a very significant piece of legislation that was approved by the voters in California that legalized medical marijuana. And 2 years later, Oregon and four other states followed, and now there are 21 states and the District of Columbia that have authorized it. There are now over 1 million legal users of medical marijuana around the country. Some people wonder, well, you have to wait to clarify marijuana policy until the federal government kind of figure out how it's going to treat. Well, for almost 20 years now, the federal government has actually decided to allow medical marijuana to be used around the country. Part of our problem that we see is that this federal classification of marijuana as a Schedule I drug with no therapeutic medicinal values and being worse than cocaine and meth no longer makes any sense. I mean, the fact is it does have proven medicinal properties, which is why there are 1 million people who use it. And if you've had any experience with people who have suffered horrific symptoms of nausea for chemotherapy, people who've used it for MS, PTSD, many of our veterans, you can find them in communities around Oregon, people who have benefited from it. I was just at an event 2 weeks ago with a deputy U.S. attorney, I won't identify where he was from, but said that the misclassification makes their job very hard. When they're before a grand jury and trying to explain why it is a Schedule I drug without medicinal character and that it is worse somehow than cocaine and meth, it makes no sense to people who are there in that setting. Well, we've watched a sea change take place. There was a signal event last fall when two states, Washington and Colorado, strong vote of their citizens, had decided to decriminalize adult recreational use of marijuana. We have also seen public opinion dramatically change over the course of the last 20 years. Now, recent surveys suggest that somewhere in the neighborhood of 58% of the public thinks that marijuana should be legalized. And if you ask the question differently, that is, should the federal government interfere with what states decide to do? Then the number of people who think that it ought to be allowed goes up to about 2-1. We currently have difficulty, though, because it is still under federal law, Schedule I, and there are all sorts of anomalies as a result of that. It puts U.S. attorneys, 84 U.S. attorneys around the country, in a difficult position. There is a gray area that we have. We are still arresting between 2/3 and 3/4 of 1 million people a year for what a majority of people think should be legal. And somewhere in the neighborhood of 30 million people use illicitly. And then, as I say, 1 million medical marijuana users. We've attempted at the federal level to start a process to help rationalize some of our policies. And I will be sharing with the committee, I thought I had extra copies with me, we'll get them to you, but it's a matrix of 11 pieces of bipartisan legislation we have in Congress to deal with trying to help the federal government be a better partner in dealing with this. Part of it, I have legislation with a colleague from Colorado, Jared Polis, that would basically legalize, tax, and regulate, treat it like alcohol. But there are a number of other areas of legislation. All of them, as I mentioned, are bipartisan. One of them that would get rid of the ludicrous prohibition on the creation of industrial hemp. In this production of industrial hemp. And Oregon was one of the leaders years ago to say, when we get to the point Oregon farmers ought to be able to grow it. We shouldn't just have to import it from Canada or Europe or some other place. And we have had clarification under the federal legislation in terms of kind of what they're going to do and when they would cut local authorities some slack, like medical marijuana, also for hemp. And I think we'll be able to move forward in Oregon with the cultivation of hemp in a way that is clear, provides a useful product, an opportunity for Oregon farmers and ranchers to have another product, and that we don't have to import it from another country. By the way, federal legislation that we have that would just sort of eliminate the prohibition altogether has somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 bipartisan co-sponsors. The lead sponsor on that is a Republican from Kentucky and is supported in that regard by Mitch McConnell and our own senior senator, Ron Wyden. And in fact, we had legislation in the Farm Bill that would authorize agricultural institutions to be able to do research with industrial hemp, and that's the first vote that anybody's seen that has been approved. It's still in the House Farm Bill. We have other pieces of legislation that actually are very likely to be resolved within the next year or two because of an anomaly that was created because some drug dealer tried to deduct the cost of his yacht that he used to smuggle cocaine. Congress jumped into the fray and made that illegal, but in so doing, they also made it, inadvertently, I think, illegal for legal marijuana businesses to deduct their business expenses. Hmm. And so perfectly legal businesses in 21 states and the District of Columbia are paying effective tax rates of 50 to 75% or more because of this disallowance. And I'm pleased to say that Grover Norquist, America's for Tax Reform, was with me in a press conference for my legislation. Another piece that I think is going to happen either administratively or legislatively, this Congress deals with the anomaly that people who are involved with legal marijuana enterprises cannot have a bank account from a federally supervised financial institution. Well, if you care about money laundering, if you care about tax evasion, or just the problems of robbery, forcing a legal enterprise to be all cash borders on lunacy. And you have people in the state of Washington right now who are figuring out how the state is going to deal with payments of thousands and thousands of dollars in cash. Well, we're working to change that, and as I say, it's very likely that that will be adjusted in the course of this Congress. And the other pieces of legislation, 11 of them in all, bipartisan, are getting more attention, and I think we're getting to a point where Congress, within the next 5 years, is going to be able to smooth these out. But that's where Oregon is in, I think, a very critical position, because we have 21 states and the District of Columbia with medical marijuana. We have two states already. Oregon is poised to be one of the next states, I think, that will have our voters legalize it. I'm quite confident if the legislation that I've seen circulated now had been on the ballot last year, I think it would have passed. Likewise, I think either of the Colorado or Washington initiatives would have done so. But what you're seeing is there are probably 8 to 10 other states that are poised to follow. In fact, Alaska is likely to change before Oregon next August in the timing of the vote that they will take. There is an opportunity for us to do it right, to focus our attention, to have appropriate research into marijuana, marijuana products, hemp, medical marijuana. Because we're in this gray area, we really can't have the capacity to do fundamental research that would make a big difference. We also, frankly, I think we have serious, serious problems in terms of how we deal with marijuana in children. The research is pretty clear that no adult has died of a marijuana overdose. It's less dangerous than things that we have more strictures on. But I think the research is absolutely clear that we don't want adolescents smoking dope. It has serious problems developmentally for them. Yet, as I've worked on this issue, I have never visited a community in the United States when I talk to people where people think that their 13-year-old daughter can't get a joint in 20 minutes. It's never happened for me. Maybe you can try this experiment yourself. And because we have 30 million Americans using it illicitly, all of it is produced by this gray market. Nobody checks the age of this 13-year-old girl seeking to buy marijuana. There's no license to lose. And it is such a vast and unregulated market. What we do is we continue to enrich Mexican drug cartels. We have ineffective local enforcement. We wildly, disproportionately visit the long arm of the law on African Americans, 12 times more likely to be incarcerated for this, even though the research is clear that white kids and black kids use it almost the identical amount. So we have sentencing disparities, we have enrichment of drug cartels, we do not have effective enforcement, and frankly, we're spending a boatload of money on a failed prohibition system, and we're not getting money in return. I'm absolutely convinced that when we make this change, which I think we will over the next 5 or 6 years nationally, allowing states to decide what they want to do and how to regulate it, but we shift from this failed prohibition and incarceration to licensing and taxing, that the delta in terms of funds is going to be in the neighborhood of about $100 billion over the next 10 years. That money is going to government or is not being spent, and leaves us in a stronger position. I deeply appreciate the courtesy to give you a little update in terms of what we're doing on the federal level, share with you some of my thoughts and observations, leave with you the material, look forward to working with you if I can help, and would be happy to entertain any comments or questions that you may have.
Congressman Blumenhauer, thank you very much. Let's see, are there questions? Representative Barton.
Thank you, Chair Prezansky, and Congressman Blumenhauer, thank you. Welcome home to where it all began for you. I have kind of a hard question for you. I'm sorry I didn't get it to you in advance, but I would be interested in your general thoughts. The Obama administration announced that in states which had legalized marijuana, they are going to de-emphasize / not prosecute marijuana in those jurisdictions. But I find that, and that was hailed by a lot of the American left, but I find that it's quite troubling whenever an administration chooses to not enforce the law. For example, what if the Nixon administration were to not enforce civil rights law, federal civil rights law in the South? Or what if the Bush administration were to not enforce environmental law? So, you know, it's troubling when you think about that. How have you wrestled with that? What are your thoughts?
It is indeed troubling. And that is why we have been working on the federal level on a bipartisan basis with these 11 pieces of legislation to help clarify the anomalies. Because 84 U.S. attorneys are in a difficult spot. And because they and the guidance that has been given, I think, is reasonable. They talk about how they're going to balance these interests. But as you know, Representative Barton, this happens all the time. We do not enforce every single law to the extent that we could. Mm-hmm. If we did, there would be probably very few operating farms in Oregon. Prosecutorial discretion is exercised routinely because we can't do everything. The resources aren't there, and prosecutors use their judgment. I think the guidance that we have extracted from the administration is reasonable to try and balance the interests, because they're not about to deny a million Americans access to medical marijuana that has been approved by local voters and makes a huge difference in the lives of people, and you probably know some of them. If you haven't visited some of the dispensaries and talked to the families who've had their physical conditions transformed, you should. And I know many of you have. They're not going to go back. They're not going to tell people in Colorado that we're going to prosecute you for obeying what is in the Colorado Constitution. That's a no-win proposition. So I think they have sought to give guidance. They want to tighten up the programs. In fact, many of the medical marijuana programs around the country, I think, should abide by this guidance. They should be more careful. That in some cases, it's pretty sloppy, and it is just a lot of there are many people who are using it under the guise of medical marijuana, but it's for recreational use. So the guidance that they've given, I think, is wise. But it is prosecutorial discretion that is exercised every single day in immigration law, in business law, in tax law. And I think they have chosen to do it here in a reasonable fashion. But I want Congress to get them off the hook. And I hope that Oregon helps provide the leadership so we get there.
Thank you. Any other questions? Congressman, thank you again for your time.
No, thank you. I appreciate the attention that you are giving to this, to be able to have the public get their arms around it. These are not easy questions, and we look forward to providing any assistance we can from the federal level, and really appreciate this deep dive that you're doing, because I think it's going to help Oregonians as they approach a decision point in the future. And I think what you do is going to help hasten the day that we have a more rational federal marijuana policy. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So with that, we're going to move into our next panel, which will be Anthony Johnson and Dave Kopak. And while they're getting situated, for those who are in the room, I should have made this announcement at the very beginning. If you have a cell phone, if it's live and active, could you please deactivate it, or at least put it on silent? And gentlemen, if you'll identify yourself before you give your presentation, that would be appreciated.
Thank you. My name is Anthony Johnson. I represent New Approach Oregon out of Portland, Oregon. Chair Przanski, members of the committee. I am greatly appreciative to have this opportunity to participate in this process as Congressman Blumenauer very eloquently and articulately demonstrated. Cannabis prohibition is a failed policy that doesn't meet any of the goals that we seek to meet in our society. I first became involved as an advocate in college and then in law school because I saw my African-American friends treated so much harshly under marijuana possession laws in Missouri, where I'm from, than my white middle-class friends, and it was just evident. And so that's why I became active in this cause. And becoming more educated on prohibition, it became obvious that kids have better access to marijuana under prohibition system than they would under regulatory system. Surveys to high school kids, junior high kids, show that kids have easier access to marijuana than they do cigarettes and alcohol. The answer is really simple. Drug dealers don't check for ID. Bartenders at McMinnon's do. And so over the course of a few years, New Approach Oregon, a coalition of advocates both nationally and locally, have listened to legislators, policymakers, community leaders, law enforcement, to devise a regulatory structure that we believe meets the criteria we need to better keep marijuana out of the hands of children, raise enough revenue to enforce a regulatory structure, also to fund education, public safety, mental health, and substance abuse programs, and to meet the federal guidelines recently laid out by the federal government. Our initiative that we have recently filed, we appreciate the legislature taking this issue up. We want to contribute in the process, but we have filed an initiative as really a backup plan because we do believe it's really important for Oregon to help lead the way in ending cannabis prohibition in this country. And so we filed an initiative that regulates marijuana substantially similar to how we do wine and beer today. The OLCC is tasked with background checks, licensing fees, and audits. Marijuana remains illegal for everyone under 21. In fact, we kept the penalties the same for everyone under 21, anyone selling to anyone under 21. Driving under the influence remains illegal. Exporting in out of state remains illegal. And the license regulatory system will mandate audits and inspections to make sure everyone within the system is toeing the line and not violating the federal guidelines laid out. It's very important to advocates as well as law enforcement that the federal guidelines are met. We don't want any marijuana program voted upon or approved by the voters here in Oregon, be it medical marijuana or a regulatory commerce system for adults, to be shut down. And so we have taken the time to develop a strict regulatory structure that we believe can satisfy these guidelines, better keep marijuana out of the hands of children. And I'm here to answer any questions that you may have. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us again. My name is Dave Kopelak. I'm a Oregon business and corporate attorney. For 19 years, I practiced mergers and acquisitions laws at Schwab, Williamson & Wyatt, a firm in Portland. I recently left to start a firm with a friend of mine, and we have a small two-person firm now. I was engaged by New Approach a while ago. Earlier this year, I suppose, I started to draft House Bill 3371, which was submitted to you all in the spring. I suppose I was the primary drafter of that, although that was quite a coalition effort. We learned a lot submitting it to you all. We worked with legislative counsel on several revisions. We had a hearing. It made it out of the Judiciary Committee, as you may know. But then, without any further progress, midsummer, I think the New Approach folks decided to go ahead and work on their initiative. So because we thought we got made a lot of good progress with House Bill 3371, and we learned a lot, we used that kind of as our starting point. I can't tell you how many meetings we had with how many people. Between July and October, I know because I was turning them, we had 27 revisions to our bill. Literally one or two a week, we had meetings incessantly. So the measure that we filed, I just want to like to impart this to you, was this was not like me and Anthony sitting in our room coming up with this. We talked to as many people as possible. A lot of advocates, a lot of activists, just policy advisors, tax experts, law enforcement. I mean, we just try to talk to as many people as possible, get as much input as possible. And I think it was really good process. I think that the measure we filed is much better than House Bill 3371 was. It's much more sophisticated. It's more nuanced and technical, and it's frankly more conservative from a law enforcement standpoint. So I think I'm here to answer any questions that you might specifically have about the measure we filed.
So, Dave, could you identify the measure, IP, what's the number on it?
We're still awaiting the 1,000 valid signatures from the Secretary of State, We're a sponsorship petition. We'll have an IP number shortly, probably within 2 weeks.
All right, questions? Representative Olson starting off.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since, Mr. Chair, you, myself, Anthony, we're all on the Rules Advisory Committee for 3460, and someone else in this room too as well, which I won't identify. But Congressman Blumenauer said something at the very beginning of his opening statement, and I got to tell you, it hit me wrong. He walks away. I mean, if the picture he's painting, I walk away with it believing that marijuana is not addictive. There is a debate constantly on both sides. I get that, whether it's addictive, whether it's dependency. I'm going to ask you this question here in a second. But the National Institute on Drug Abuse says that long-term use can lead to addiction. Psychology Today, just the most recent article, says that there is evidence that supports that it is addictive. And then the most overwhelming piece that I find comes from two doctors, Dr. Robert DuPont and Andrea Barthwell, are members of the American Society of Addiction Medicine. They flip flop say that it is addictive. I'm curious your thoughts.
So, like you mentioned, Representative Olson, there's a debate on each side, and you can find scientists on one side, they'll say, and researchers, that it's not addictive. Others will say that it will addictive. I think the evidence is clear that it is one of the most least addictive drugs, and definitely less addictive than alcohol and nicotine, and tobacco, cigarettes, Oxycontin, Percocets, Valium, Vicodin. So I don't want to discount that it may be addictive, but it's definitely less addictive than other substances we have legalized. And if we're worried about addiction and people seeking treatment for their addictions and getting help, we need to bring marijuana use out of the black market and underground market and into mainstream society as a health issue instead of a law enforcement criminal issue, so people are more willing to be open about their use and how it may be impacting their life positively or adversely. I think we see it with recently there have been a couple of politicians that have gotten in trouble for getting caught with drugs or being, you know, using drugs, and both of them admit that they used alcohol and they have an alcohol problem. Since alcohol has been legalized this long, people are much more willing to be open and honest about their alcohol problem and seek treatment for that. And so people are going to use marijuana regardless of whether it's illegal or not. And so it's better to bring it into the mainstream, into really reality of people using it, and to use the tax revenue to fund substance abuse and mental health treatment so people can seek the help they need.
Good. Thank you.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For either of our witnesses, could you describe, in perhaps limited particularity, are you prepared to describe the differences between the measure that you have submitted or prospectively could submit and the Washington State or Colorado ballot measures that have passed already?
Mm-hmm. In our measure, we do allow for limited home cultivation, which is not allowed under the Washington measure, but is allowed under the Colorado measure. The Colorado measure legalized 6 plants, and home cultivators could possess all that was harvested off of those 6 plants. We limit the home cultivation to 4 plants per household and to 8 ounces, so it's really less, or it's more restrictive than what they legalized in Colorado. In Washington, they prohibited what's called like vertical integration. So a processor has to sell to a producer has to sell to a processor, has to sell to a retailer. It's taxed at 25% at each level. And then there's a sales tax on top of that. In our measure, we allow vertical integration. So, and we have a flat tax of $35 per ounce. We believe our tax structure is in the right kind of sweet spot, if you will, to where it's taxed enough to generate revenue that we need, but not taxed too high, so that the regulated market can compete with the black market. We call for research to study the impact upon driving under the influence, and the OLCC is mandated to examine existing research and conduct new studies if necessary and report back to the legislature. That type of research isn't called for in the other measures. And unlike, I think, the Washington measure, we allow for a county opt-out similar to alcohol. So cities and counties can both, if they so choose, can be a dry county for marijuana just like they do with alcohol. And that's not included in every other measure. Am I missing anything?
I'll just jump in for a second. we went with a statutory measure, as Washington did. Colorado's was constitutional. We just thought a statutory measure made sense for Oregon. We modeled it. We wanted to regulate it in a manner like alcohol, like beer and wine, so we looked at a liquor statute. So, I mean, I would say two-thirds of our measure is straight out of the existing Liquor Act. We had to deviate in places where it made logical sense, but there were a lot of places where the statutes made a lot of sense. I mean, the Liquor Commission is going to, if this passes, will regulate this. And so they know these statutes, they know how to regulate it, and all this stuff about protecting minors, and there's just a lot of things that just, we literally copied and pasted. We had to change some words, obviously, but that was our default position. Stick with the Liquor Act. And again, we deviated where possible, but where we had to. But I think that's, I mean, it's an Oregon measure, and we look to the existing Oregon enforcement structure as our basis.
Can I follow up?
Yes, you may.
My impression of House Bill 3371 is that it was basically an incomplete. Well, that sounded, I don't mean to offend anybody, but it wasn't ready to go. I think that bill, from what I gather, had something on the scale of about 100 unaddressed portions of the Oregon Revised Statutes in regards to references to controlled substances and the like, are you following what I'm asking here? And that needed to be fixed before anything could be really considered legal within the state. 3371, I suspect, would not have actually legalized marijuana in the state because of its just lack of addressing various portions of the Oregon Revised Statutes. So I want to first ask whether that's been contemplated or addressed with the ballot measure that you've submitted.
I'm not exactly sure what you're referring to. I mean, okay. we certainly intended House Bill 3371 to legalize, you know, marijuana. But now, if you're talking about the term controlled substance, that's a kind of a very technical legal thing we had to deal with. Is that, go ahead.
Well, I am talking about that because in order to actually legalize something, you have to cover every technical legal particular of it.
Well, I'm aware of that.
I know you are. Well, and on a, may I follow up, Mr. Chairman?
Are you talking federally or state, the state definition or the federal definition?
I'm talking about references within the Oregon Revised Statutes to controlled substances that would need to be addressed on any bill that, or a ballot measure that would legalize anything, marijuana in this case. Could I, another example of that, my impression of 3371, and I could be wrong about this, but was that you could actually, it basically would allow the following scenario. So two people are in a car, and there is marijuana found in the car. One person is 21 years old, the other was 20. And the person who is 21 years old, let's say it's 4 or 4.5 ounces of marijuana they jointly possess, the 21-year-old would have committed no crime whatsoever, but the 20-year-old, by virtue of his birthday, the son having not come up on his 21st birthday, would be going down for a felony, potentially. Delivery, possession, manufacture. Has that been addressed in the ballot measure that you've submitted?
Well, I'm not exactly sure of the problem. I mean, we may need to have some follow-up on this.
Okay.
Mere possession is not a felony for a first-time person who's 20 years old. So, we drew a bright line between minors under 21 and those over 21. And so we're legalizing it for those over 21. If you're under 21, we're basically not touching the statute. If you're an adult delivering to a minor, we're not touching the statute.
That's what I was asking.
Okay. Yeah.
And just earlier drafts, we actually removed marijuana out of the Controlled Substances Act and Oregon law, but under our newest initiative, we just merely carve out an exception for people over 21. And the problem about 4.5 ounces in a car is also addressed in our newest measure in that we don't allow transportation of anything more than an ounce. So if they had 4.5 ounces, that would be illegal under our initiative.
All right, Representative Garrett.
Sheehan, I'll pass.
All right. Other questions, Senator?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So one of the questions we're going to have to wrestle with in February here is, you know, do we want to move forward with legislation that might refer the question to the people? And I'm curious to know your thoughts on that. The different routes, the advantages of going the initiative route as opposed to a referral route, and if it's a referral route, should it just be a framework or should it actually be something that's pretty explicit about every aspect of a potential program? So I don't know if you've had any thoughts about that.
Yeah, we'll have to, consider the referral as the language gets developed and it moves along during a legislative session. Personally, I feel laying out some strict rules and controls is a better way to go, although I do understand the political roadblocks that can arise when you try to have a deeply detailed regulatory structure, especially in a short, February session. So I think that the legislature will definitely want to consider the guidelines to make sure the federal government's concerns are addressed. And I think it would probably be best to have certain rules and regulations in place. And then I think as time goes along, public opinion and polling may give us some idea as to what the voters really want to see. Do they just want the basic referral and the legislature deal with the rules and regulations later, or do they want to see a more detailed provision? But we definitely appreciate the legislature, working on this issue regardless of how it ultimately ends up.
Other questions?
Yeah, I would like to. If I may, thank you. This is a bit of a comment, but I do want to. So I'm stressing the importance of our engagement as legislators on this issue at this point, because a lot of us are very aware that touching a ballot measure in this building on any subject is not easy. Is not easy, and so the public goes and passes. The electorate passes. Let's say theoretically in November of next year, your ballot measure. Well, if there are flaws in there, if there's these kinds of things that I'm bringing up now, it seems kind of picky, but if the legislature has to come through after the ballot measure, and that may be easy, but then again, we've been dealing with ballot measures through most of this year, not in marijuana, measure 11 and the like, and the enthusiasm there is limited.
Yeah, I definitely am sympathetic with that issue, but I think whether it's a referral or whether it's initiative, the legislature is going to likely have to go back and review this issue and address it. The Oregon Medical Marijuana Act, as it was passed by voters in 1998, is a lot different than it is today, and that's through a few revisions by the legislature. So I think whether it's a referral and the legislative body devises the rules and regulations later, or an initiative passes rules and regulations, I have confidence that this legislative body will address the needs of Oregon.
I'll add that we all know the federal memo that came out in the 8 points, and so I think if our measure passes or anything like it passes, we're all going to be in the same boat, right? And no one will want the federal government to come in because we have a lax, and because the statute's not right, because enforcement isn't right. I mean, businesses will have been started. People will have jobs. We will have tax revenue. Nobody has an interest in screwing that up. And so I think that that if the legislature has to come in and fix something, I mean, we will be there with you to suggest recommendations, because I think we just all have to stay on top of it. Our tax provision is just an example. This is a very difficult issue. There are so many theories on how this should be taxed and how you find that sweet spot for to minimize the black market or eliminate the black market, but still, maximize tax revenue. Somewhere in there is a sweet spot. How to do it is very complicated, and so we recognize that. I highly doubt, and I think we've made the best choice, but I highly doubt that that's going to, survive several legislative sessions beyond it. There's going to have to be some tinkering, and we put in a provision that said that the OLCC should constantly look at this and make recommendations to the legislature. So as far as the legislature coming in a year later and tinkering with it or fixing it, we would expect it. Unless we got this thing perfect, we would welcome it. And so I don't know what the practical difficulties you've had in the past, but this is an issue where I think we're all going to be in the same boat, because we don't want the federal government coming in and pointing to us as people who irresponsibly are enforcing an act. So I think, again, that may give some background.
Thank you.
All right, any other questions, comments?
So what I'll just conclude with this to let you know that the reality in this building, it does seem that once the citizens have passed something, it's very hard for members to actually take up the issue early on after passage, because it's the will of the voters. At least that's what people feel and the politics understand. We've had situations where promoters of measures have actually come in and have asked for changes, and that's something we would expect if, let's say, your ballot measure does go forward and if it is passed by the voters, because clearly we all are acknowledging at this point it hasn't been fully vetted through this process to ensure that we're crossing the T's, dotting the I's, and we also understand that between now, in the sense of when it would qualify for the ballot and when it would actually be implemented, there may be changes, there could be occurrences in Washington State or Colorado, and the feds may give other directives that would tell us that we need to make some changes. So I appreciate your willingness to work with us throughout this process, both on what could be a legislative referral coming out in February, as well as if your measure does in fact meet the qualifications to go forward and gets the signatures to go forward, and instead of the other one in the vote in November. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
So our next presenter is Hillary Bricken, I believe.
Thank you. And for the record, my name is Hillary Bricken. I'm a lawyer with the Cana Law Group, which is a practice area of my bigger law firm called Harrison Morey in Seattle. I've had the benefit of being an industry attorney for the past 4 years, seeing it through with medical marijuana and eventually into the passage of 502. It has not been an easy road, and since the passage of I-502, I am not as optimistic as I once was that Washington actually did get it right. And I did create a PowerPoint for today, which I'm hoping someone will just, I'm assuming I just press arrows to make it go back and forth? Okay. But I almost wish I hadn't, because I really think Q&A on this subject is more valuable than any information I'm going to parrot at you.
Hillary, let me just say, it's your presentation, and we're here to hear and take in. If you want to, you know, let's say go lightly on that PowerPoint, and just, we'll have copies of that that people can look at. But we, you know, I'm going to say, as a co-chair, the chair on this committee, I would value your input as to how you think and what you feel that we need to know as we move forward, because the reality is we have today, we have one more set of legislative days in January, and then if we are going to move forward with some type of legislative perspective, such as a referral, it would have to be pretty well on its way by then to be ready to go in February. So however you'd like to proceed.
Well, having heard that, I'm going to spare you the PowerPoint, because you can always print out the slides. I really only have 4 main points, and maybe even a 5th one after what we've heard from the other witnesses. And if you can't hear me or if I'm going too quickly, please stop me and ask me to repeat myself. Very obviously, the first point, strictly regulated regimes of the future. Unless and until federal prohibition falls, if you're not meeting those 8 points in the Cole memo from August 29th, 2013, the federal government will have something to say about your law. And whether or not that takes the form of them actually suing you in federal court and the expenditure of tax dollars, or worst case scenario, in most times, enforcement, that's not a good thing. It's not a good thing for the state. It's not a good thing for the participants. As far as strictly regulated regimes go, learning from Washington system, more than one agency ought to be regulating this industry. I do not think that the Liquor Control Board, while they've done a really good job in Washington, is fully equipped going forward to handle the capacity of what's going to take place in this marketplace, because it is so unpredictable. For example, the Liquor Control Board, all of a sudden, in their infinite wisdom, decided that sun-grown marijuana was the way to go, because east of the Cascades, we have robust farm territory. They thought that marijuana would fit in really well with apples and cherries. Unfortunately for them, the regulation of sun-grown cannabis really isn't in their wheelhouse. They're an enforcement agency. They don't necessarily know a lot about agriculture, despite the fact that they go and they interact with wineries. Obviously, that's horticulture. My bottom line, multiple agencies should be looking at this. And I know I'm coming from the perspective of Washington. We also have an office in Illinois. They just legalized, and they have at least 3 agencies looking at this recent legislative bill that went through. It's basically the Department of Revenue, the Department of Agriculture, and the Department of Financial Regulations that's looking at dealing with the dispensaries. And and they are two very different animals when you're talking about retail versus cultivation. Obviously, age limits, it's a really smooth transition into the liquor laws because of that restriction on 21 and over. The federal government seems...
Hillary, I'm going to ask you to just move the microphone back. It's very sensitive and you won't get the feedback.
Okay.
Thank you.
So the 21 and up restriction, the feds seem really quite comfortable with that. They are tolerant of that particular age limit. I don't recommend a state going lower than that. Unfortunately, in Washington, we had many controversies because there were no age limits in our very vague medical marijuana laws. And we'll get into dealing with bad medical marijuana laws in the end. But strictly regulated regimes are the way to go. And moving forward, what comes off of that is tax revenue. Washington has many hurdles in front of it because we decided that a 25% excise tax was the way to go. And that's 25% excise tax on every sale of marijuana. Very quickly, the board learned that this would create barriers to entry that even responsible actors would not want to deal with because of the threat of the black market and the medical market, which remains on its whole untaxed. So 25% was what we chose, and eventually the board decided that for certain participants in the licensing sphere, a tax exemption was warranted. But they cannot get around that, which gets back to a people's initiative versus a legislative referral or bill. I'm sure you all know in Washington it's 2 years before the legislature can touch the bill unless a supermajority vote is convened. So that tax structure is very likely here to stay. In my opinion, also on the other side, it was one of the reasons why the initiative passed in the first place. And a lot of that revenue obviously is going to go to schools, healthcare, rehabilitation. It's all going to go into the general fund after the fact. Now you juxtapose that with black market sales. No drug dealer is probably going to go above $10 a gram. And in Washington, we're fully expecting anywhere between $13 and $15 a gram. So the black market will be competitive. What are the mitigating factors there? Tourism. Number one, in our initiative, we did not restrict use by residency. You can come from anywhere in the world as long as you're 21 and up, and you can use and possess in Washington State. The black market simply won't attract that type of attention. Additionally, the products are better. The due diligence, the testing, the safety standards, the quality control ensure that superior products will be in the regulated marketplace. And if you're an older constituent or whatever type of constituent you are, if you care about what you're putting into your body, you're not going to continue to go to the black market. But that tension between taxes, tax revenue, and black market sales, definitely an issue. Number three, and this is something that hasn't really been discussed in detail yet, pushback from cities and counties. It will absolutely happen. My law firm right now is preparing at least two lawsuits against municipalities that I will not name, that in their decision to move forward, because we did not give cities and counties the option to opt out. In fact, we made it very clear that any city or locality that would preempt 502 would be in trouble. It would not stand. Now, that's an obvious constitutional principle anyway, but what cities and counties are doing is flying in the face of it. They are ignoring it. And it's gotten so bad that the Liquor Control Board has finally asked for a formal opinion from our Attorney General to pronounce that cities and counties cannot opt out. They cannot ban it. Now, even if our AG comes out and says that they can't, it's not binding, it's not law, it's very likely that these cities and counties will move forward with prohibition, which can really defeat that necessary access that makes legalization successful. So be clear in whatever you do, what they can and cannot do. And I warn you against including an opt-out provision, because if too many opt out, you will create an environmental effect that you may not want. You may create green light communities that further disenfranchise neighborhoods that really don't need that impact. Also, it could really stymie the tax revenue and ultimately crater legalization in its successful mode. Washington's going to deal with that. We have many cities and counties that have, quote unquote, opted out, and that's going to be played out between the applicants and the municipalities in court. The Liquor Control Board will have nothing to do with it. Lastly, dealing with the existing medical marijuana community. This is a very difficult issue. And in Washington, we've had medical since 1998. People are not ready to relinquish it. However, as part of our Senate budget that passed last session, the Liquor Control Board was tasked with undertaking the study of merging the two industries. And this is something that every medical state is going to have to decide if they're looking at legalization. Do you roll these industries into one and say, if you want to medicate, feel free to visit your local shop? Or do you make these carve-outs for patients that they may or may not need? And I think that that issue really depends on the type of patients that you're dealing with. In Washington, we had over 200 dispensaries in the city of Seattle alone. That number was borderline absurd. They were not required to go through any municipal vetting, so they all took up place in Seattle, and I can guarantee you, because we represent a lot of the market, that 80 to 85% of these transactions are black market, gray market transactions. So the Liquor Control Board and the state are now wrangling with how to make accommodations for legitimate patients, people that are truly sick, versus that gray market that stands to only compete with and defeat the purpose of 502. The Liquor Control Board specifically wants to take away home growing. They are looking at taking it away, and it's probably the most controversial issue. They are looking to reduce patient amounts from 24 ounces, it's about a pound and a half, down to 3. They're going to take away delivery, and they want to push patients to go to these I-502 storefronts, potentially with a tax exemption like you'd find in normal prescription drugs. And just to lead off, not necessarily on a downer, but kind of as a cautionary tale, while I love initiative writers and I really appreciate what Anthony and Dave are trying to do, I sincerely hope you work with them going forward on the tweaks. Washington did not have that benefit. Our governor made it very clear that she did not want to touch medical marijuana, and state legislators, with the exception of 2, really followed in her wake. And we're dealing with the fallout of what the initiative now looks like. And just a small example, Washington decided to define THC at a very low amount. Why? To legalize industrial hemp. Well, at the same time, you had drug dealers, and it's not that people, Dave made a good point, people don't want these things to fail. We want to beat the federal government, and it is a question of beating the federal government into submission, given the current political atmosphere. While people will not intend things to fail, they will absolutely game the system. I don't think I have to tell anybody that, but especially in the marijuana industry, because it's cutting edge and it's new and people want to make a lot of money. That is the truth. Well, because we defined THC at less than 0.3%, we had drug dealers around high schools dealing Mexican ditch weed to kids. And it was so low that the prosecutors could not prosecute these people accordingly. So now, because the laws are not retroactive, they can't go back and prosecute them for the crimes they committed. But that was the one subject that the legislature was able to convene a two-thirds majority vote on. And that has been it, to make sure that they can now prosecute these people that are dealing low-grade weed to kids. So I do recommend team collaboration between your initiative writers and yourselves, and I do think that Oregon is in a really special position because you already have guidance from the federal government that we did not have, and we went out on a limb for it. And even though I am excited about 502, I do think it has a lot of potential. We are going to be a laboratory, that is for sure, dealing with the black market and the medical market, and we really hope that you can learn from that and do better.
Thank you very much. Questions? Representative Hicks first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Ms. Bricken. So I'll just ask one, though I would have otherwise many. This tax thing, I mean, people say all the time, oh, we should legalize it and tax it. And I hear the sentiment there, but it is so risky taxing marijuana, because if you put it too high, then all you do is reinforce the black market. And one thing that people don't talk about, maybe even recognize, is that, you know, Washington and Colorado are vastly different when it comes to marijuana than Oregon is. This is the source of the black market. If anywhere in the United States a small amount of high-grade marijuana is found, it likely came from an indoor grow site. If anywhere in the United States, in North America, a large amount of high-grade marijuana is found, it only came from one place.
Your district.
Yeah. That's right. It came from my district.
Wait a second.
That's my interest in this issue, because he's right. He said it before I could have. No, it's true. And I love my district. I mean, the point is, I mean, we got to be real, real careful. I'll just leave it there, because it could get real ugly real fast in a way that Washington wouldn't even have to contemplate.
Well, I concur, and I don't have a magic number, and I don't necessarily think there is a magic number. A lot of this is social conditioning. People pay tremendous amounts of taxes to smoke cigarettes. They would do it for alcohol too, but that's because of years of social conditioning of acceptance. You will not compete with black market dealers. the answer to that is increased enforcement. And just FYI footnote, the other initiative mistake that was made was that out of these tax dollars, the initiative writers forgot to give a piece to the cities and the counties. So they have no money for increased enforcement to deal with the fallout locally. And even though we have state actors and enforcement agencies, they can only be in so many places at so many times. And the LCB didn't even get the full budget they asked for to accommodate enforcement. So do not forget your municipalities. Increased enforcement is the key. That is the only way. Otherwise, I have no happy tax number.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Senator Close.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hillary, you've given one reason the cities and counties are opting out. Is that the only reason? Are there others that they are concerned with other than the lack of money for law enforcement?
No, I'd say there's multiple reasons. We had one county, Lewis County in the southwest. They asked that people get permits from the DEA to operate before they open their I-502 shop. They are still worried about federal prosecution, and I think the underlying factor there is not really the prosecution they're concerned with. They're going to lose federal funds if they engage in the program. That's number one. Number two is probably legitimate public health and safety concerns. Their communities are just not ready to have this type of activity there. We have a very large military installation base around Tacoma, Joint Base Lewis-McChord. The three cities that border that installation have all said absolutely not. We don't want to put troops in that position because they'll be chaptered out of the military. So it's really multifold based on the community, but it's that mix between a lack of law enforcement, a lack of community enthusiasm, and, in my opinion, a pretextual fear of federal prosecution.
Thank you.
All right, let's see. I think I have Representative Garrett first and then Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a general question. Do you think we are better off as policymakers trying to think through all the potential issues of which you just gave us a flavor before we put the issue to the voters and have it all spelled out? Or are we better off maybe recognizing that we can't possibly foresee all those issues ahead of time and instead ask the voters for more of a authorization to proceed with developing a program?
Man, it's just a tremendously difficult question because there are some things that are latent even for us that we're not going to see until 12 months down the line. Honestly, as lawmakers, I do think you're well positioned. You deal with tons of issues, and this is not just about marijuana. I mean, this is a mental health issue. This is an urban issue. This is a race issue. And I think that you've all probably in your careers to this point have been dealing with those issues. And I think you have to contemplate that when you look at something like this, especially with federal prohibition. I do not think that this is something that necessarily should be left to the will of the people to its extreme. And what do I mean about that? If you've never run a corporate business, you have no idea how hard it is to cultivate, manufacture, and sell something, and that includes marijuana. There could be tremendous failure rates if the law allows for it. There are massive loopholes in 502 that people will game that I'm confident that legislators at least could have debated and maybe tightened up a little bit. It's a very exciting subject. I think people become very enthused about it. I'm not positive that they're intellectually equipped to deal with the details, which is why I do think that legislatures should have a grip on this before it hits the people. And in Washington, we really didn't have a choice. And now we're dealing with some of the fallout of that. But that's what was right for Washington at the time. Our medical laws were so bad. People were being prosecuted left and right. They were losing property. Our governor was not going to help. So it was almost like an emergency measure that the people took it into their own hands. But again, you're just in a very unique position to examine most, if not all, of the policy issues. And some of these details will always have to play out in the marketplace, and nobody can predict them. But I think you can certainly hedge your bets before the public can in general.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How is Washington State dealing with driving under the influence issues?
Thank you for reminding me. This, like taxes, is another one of those notorious trade-up chips that gets these things to pass. With the DUI in our state, if you have 0.5% nanograms of THC in your system, it is a per se DUI violation. Currently, they're dealing with it on a case-by-case basis. We had the first one last year, right after the initiative passed. A pedestrian was struck and hit in a crosswalk, and the pedestrian actually was at fault. But because of 502, the individual that was driving was intoxicated. They were high. They were actually taken in, even though the pedestrian was at fault. Now, exercising prosecutorial discretion, the Vancouver Police Department dropped the charges because the pedestrian was clearly at fault, but it was one of those scary moments where it was a department decision, and it's out of the hands of the state. There's been a lot of backlash on the science behind that level, that threshold, because that is one of the key reasons why this is not like alcohol. The effects are tremendously different, and drivers behave differently, and if you're dealing with someone who's a legitimate patient, they are going to be quite the functional stoner. They are not going to be erratically driving on the roads. And the science behind these numbers is faulty because no comprehensive studies have been undertaken to really tell us what's that limit where you cannot operate a vehicle. So in Washington, it's on a case-by-case basis. Many people thought the sky would fall, that police would use it as pretext to prosecute. That has not happened.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you. Hillary, thank you very much for being here today and giving us your perspectives, and hopefully in the future we may be able to have your assistance as we move forward.
I'd be happy to provide it. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Our last presenter for this topic is Paul Schmidt.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen of the committee. It's a pleasure to be before you today. In brevity, I'll speed up what could drag on for a long time. I come from a different point of view.
We need to have your name on the record.
And for the record, it's Paul Schmidt. I am retired, caring for elderly parents. The background and why I'm here today is I've got 34 years in law enforcement experience, 24 years with the Drug Enforcement Administration. I retired here in Portland, at which time I went back to the state of Colorado to help in the care of my parents. While I was in the state of Colorado, I was contacted by their Department of Revenue, who had a brand new program, and that was the Medical Marijuana Enforcement Division, and they said with my history, my knowledge, and my reputation within the state of Colorado, it'd be a perfect fit. So 2 days later, I was the agent in charge of enforcement operations in the state of Colorado under the Department of Revenue. In brevity, 18 months in the implementation of medical marijuana, which I refer to as medical cannabis, and the use and the setup, as Anthony said before, a vertical integration system from the cultivation of cannabis to the medical marijuana centers, and then obviously into the kitchens that were making infused products from cannabis. Some of the lessons that we learned in our initial 18 months from an enforcement side and from a program implementation side were, number one, funding. The industry is a brand new industry. It's an unknown industry. And to base funding for any regulatory schedule on the industry itself turned out to be a disaster. Department of Revenue, most all revenue departments are based on the industry that they're regulating. With cannabis and the new industry, which it is, as far as consumptions, use, and so forth, there was no history track to base what funding would be available for the department. Initially, they said there'd be 75 employees. We got up to 55 employees, at which time we were broke. With 55 employees, we still couldn't regulate what Colorado had set out within four offices of the state. Definitely funding is a key to any regulation scheme. It needs to be properly funded, whether that comes out of a general fund, but it has to be a fund not dependent on the industry and not dependent on the sales. The second thing we learned very quickly was training and experience and education, not only within the regulatory scheme, but also with the public. The general public, even though they know marijuana, have probably seen marijuana, probably smelt marijuana, the effects of marijuana. A lot of the general population has no idea what marijuana, cannabis really is or how it affects an individual, including my mother, who is 71 years old, who says, please explain to me, son, what's the difference between medical marijuana and bad marijuana? How do you know the difference between the two? And again, just from experience, training is so important, which I felt was a perfect blend for my skills and my trade when I went to Colorado, because within the Department of Revenue, setting up a brand new division, they had no experience whatsoever in dealing with cannabis, from the cultivation aspects, from the regulatory aspects, from dispensing aspects, and even the money involved and the movement of money. So again, training expertise has always got to be behind the program, not only on the regulatory side, but again, just in the general education of the public. Some of the things we came up with in a very quick note is best practices of the industry. As compliance and regulatory, we're there administratively and civilly. We're not there to crush a new industry. We're there to help them be compliant. A lot of we learned within the first 12 months was helping dispensaries, helping cultivation sites, helping kitchens and infused products learn what they need to do to be compliant. One of the things I've heard from my previous speakers, the black market, always competing with the black market. No matter what we do today here in the state of Oregon, no matter what we do in any state, the black market will still exist. No matter what we try, the black market's always going to be there. Can we compete with the black market? No, you can't. And that's just not with cannabis. It's not the black market of anything. A regular business cannot compete with a black market. They're not regulated, they don't pay fees, they don't pay taxes, and they don't pay royalties. So no matter what we talk about as a commodity, a regular licensed business recognized will never be able to compete within a black market concept for the same product. What I say is between the industry themselves, regulation is a must. Those within the industry will agree. I believe Anthony and others have stated they want a legitimate industry developed here. Colorado chose to keep medical marijuana separate from the retail sale of marijuana. The shops, the centers, and the cultivations can exist in the same location, but they've gone and moved forward to have a complete linear separation between the two operations, even though a dispensary, for lack of better terms, is located at one location. January 1st, if you walk into that location and you're there to purchase the open use of marijuana, you go to the right. If you're there on a medical application with a medical card, you go to the left. But they've chosen to keep both models in place. With that, again, with Washington, with Oregon coming online, 34 years in law enforcement, to tell my mother, to tell and sit before you today and say I would be here today, I would have never dreamed it. I think the general consensus within law enforcement is where cannabis is today in our society. We would never have dreamed this 15 years ago. The question isn't if, the question is really when. And it is here, and it's something we need to deal with. I believe my peers in senior management within law enforcement call us dinosaurs, if you will. But we went down swinging, and we always said, you know, I'll be dead in the ground before I see someone smoking cannabis or marijuana on a street corner in my face. That was the old guard. That's the environment we grew up in. You look at law enforcement today, you look at some of my peers 50 years and older, or 50 years and younger, I should say, the younger, they'll come and tell you, I just can't wait till cannabis is regulated and in the market so we can move on with our responsibilities. We're seeing a change. Unfortunately, we're living through those changes right now, and it's very difficult because of change. Nobody likes change, and as the older we get, the harder it is for us to change. But we need to keep our eyes open, and I think some of my fellow brethren have chose to put their head in a hole and ignore the situation thinking it's going to go away. And it's not. And I, every chance I get, whether at a Lions Club, Rotary Club, or within my own peer group, I am always preaching we need to get out in front of this to make sure that this brand new industry can survive and that it survives for public safety with proper regulation and a scheme for it, whether that's under the Oregon Health Authority, whether it's under the Department of Revenue, whether it's under public safety. We just need to ensure that what we say is going to be regulatory is there, not only for the public safety, but also the safety of the industries and those who choose to be within the industry. And I open that up for any questions.
Paul, thank you.
Of course. I'll make it short. Thank you. Now, I am very, very interested in your take on this, and that last point is exactly what I want to continue on with. I completely agree that a properly licensed player can never compete with an unlicensed black market player. So based, but the other side of that coin is that it creates an incentive for the licensed operator to basically report violations of competitors to law enforcement. And the way you're going to get information and access to or insight about who the black market people are and what they're doing is probably through the licensed operators. Does that sound about right?
In the state of Colorado, the majority of our complaints and, quote, tips came in were from the industry themselves. And they know, as always, who within the business. It was very easy as a regulator to walk in a business and see who really knew exactly the price per pound, the price per light, what they're paying for electricity, what their lease was on their property, what it was costing them to put a product out for sale, and what they had to clear per gram to break even and then to make a profit. They knew that, like, instantly. It was easy to go into establishment, and again, you look at that establishment, look at the record, the practices in place, and they couldn't tell you how much a high-pressure sodium bulb cost. They couldn't tell you what a water pump was costing them. And it was easy to see who was taking money under the table and who was operating within the black market, because cost didn't matter to them. And one of the reasons was is they weren't compliant and they weren't playing by the rules. And that, again, with a strong program of compliance and regulatory and rules, it evens the playing field. And the worst I felt after leaving after 18 months and coming back to Oregon was the fact I saw so many new business practices put everything on the line, from their life savings to really their freedoms, not knowing if the knock on the door was law enforcement or a neighbor. And they were trying to be compliant with everything that they were asked for, and yet they saw those who chose not to be compliant and break the rules and having no issues whatsoever.
One quick one, because I've got others.
Thank you. That's such a great, great, great point about why the law enforcement piece must be adequately capable of addressing the complaints that come in. I mean, that's because if the licensure system is ever going to work, when they call law enforcement, someone has actually got to follow up on the lead.
Correct. And have the resources to do so.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Done.
Representative Garrett.
Thank you. On this question of the black market, it's interesting what you've said. I would have come into this conversation a little bit more hopeful that a system of regulation helps us limit the black market. And you seem to be saying something kind of different. Isn't there some, can we be a little bit more optimistic about reducing black market trade as we have in alcohol and tobacco by legalizing marijuana, or am I missing the point?
No, sir. You're right on actually hitting the nail on the head there. By regulating it and bringing it in, you will have an effect on the black market. Whether it's tobacco, alcohol, it's the same thing. You can choose as an individual, and it's an individual choice, am I going to purchase my medicine or my open use of cannabis from the black market, or am I going to go to a legitimized center or facility under Oregon's law that's set up to purchase it? It's your choice. It's the same way whether you go into a liquor store or a tobacco establishment. Am I going to buy it from a reputable dealer that stands behind their product and I know what I'm getting, or am I going to buy it from an unknown source to save $2. It goes back to our principles as being individuals. How many of us say, oh, I'm not going to buy that product in Washington because I don't want to pay the sales tax, or I don't want to drive and I'm just going to get it, you know, somewhere else or off the internet? It's kind of that same human thing. The black market, I don't mean it's going to thrive and stay here, but a prime example from Colorado, not to continue on too long, and I apologize, a lot of the centers there, medical marijuana centers, it would cost them about $1,800 to $2,500 a pound to produce if they were paying employees, paying utilities, paying licenses, and so forth. They could go to a caregiver who, under the Colorado scheme, could cultivate for their patients and give their patients their allotted amount and still end up with 3 to 5 pounds of good, usable product at the end of a grow cycle. They could go then to a center and say, hey, how much will you pay me per pound? And the center says, well, it's costing me $1,800 to $2,500 a pound to produce here. How about I give you $1,200 or $1,100? Yeah, that's great. That's with me. No paperwork, no nothing. And that's how we're saying the black market does affect a legitimate business. Will it ever go away? No. But can we have a great effect on it? Oh, definitely. And the best regulators are those within the industry. And again, when we meet at our association meetings, when we meet together, we're going to know, hey, wait a minute, how come you're prospering so much when the majority of the 90% of us over here are barely making it by?
Thank you.
All right. Senator Denbrough.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, this week's New Yorker has a really interesting profile of a guy named Mark Kleinberg, or is it Kleinman, from UCLA, who's a national expert on marijuana laws. And he makes a very interesting point that in the earliest days of regulation, that's where we need to be putting the most money into enforcement, because it's important at the very beginning to have people sort of scared away from the black market and into the welcoming arms of the legitimate establishments. The challenge that he saw in Washington State was that they didn't dedicate tax revenue for enforcement at the local or county level, and he fears that that's going to be counterproductive there. So I think that's a really interesting point for us to consider as we move down this road. Your initial point that the law enforcement should not, or enforcement, or the administration regulation should not be done with revenues from the industry, I wonder if you could speak more to that, because where else is it going to come from?
Well, like Colorado was the prime example. Setting up 55 employees with the establishment of a new unit within the Department of Revenue, you had your fixed cost, your leases, your cars, your support, your computers, your phone lines, your telecommunications, your radios. That destroyed a $10 million budget overnight, not to mention full-time employees with benefits. What happened there, because the funding was sold strictly on the industry, they were supposed to be licensed within a year. The first year came and went, and no one had been licensed because the process initially took so long to do a background for the industry. And again, problems with back taxes, problems with forged documents, problems not being able to support what was in the application. Because they missed that 12-month operation, there were no license fees to be generated for the new year. So what was thought would be an influx of millions of dollars from registry fees never happened. So the division itself, setting itself up, hopefully, that should have had new funding coming in 12 months, really never had funding almost 2.5 years later. And that's why they went from 55 employees down to 12.
Okay. So just to follow up, so there are lessons there for us to learn.
I would say there can be a combination of funding, which I think is really the way to go, that the funding for the actual operations needs to come from a general source, So it's not a battle every year, how much is our funding going to be this year? It's just a matter of, you know, the funds are there and good, it's just what amount of those funds are you going to get? I also believe a lot of the taxation funds and the funds placed on industry themselves, that is the money that should really be placed back into the community, whether it be a municipality or a county, but those are the funds to go support their efforts and let them decide, do we increase our enforcement efforts here, increase training for our citizenry, treatment, you know, let those funds actually go back into the community where they were generated, as opposed coming back to the state level to support the program.
So at this point, what I'm going to do is I'm asking Bill or Mike to hand out my draft. I have a draft I wanted to introduce, but I wanted to wait till we had all our presentations, which is an approach that I will be moving forward for the legislature to be looking at in February. It does, in fact, take in a lot of the concerns that I think the presenters have raised as to how we should be going forward. My perspective on this is that we should not at this point ask the voters to pass a detailed bill without it being fully vetted through this process. And so what this draft will show you is basically setting the parameters and the sideboards. It does have all of the Eric Holder 8-point requirements of what we need to address, and also has other parameters of what we think as a state would want. If this goes forward and if we are move this out of the February session, what this would do is ask the voters to determine whether or not they want to have us as a legislature in 2015 to draft the actual legislation based on their approval of wanting this type of program in this state. And what I think is very important is what we've heard from some of the presenters is at this point we have a lot to learn from the two states that are going embarking down this road right now. And for us to actually be in a position that if we even had the time, which I do not believe we have the time between now and February, to fully vet a full composed bill that would have all the ins and outs into it, we will actually be able to learn from what those two states are going through. We'll know where the federal government is going with this enforcement and their oversight, and it will in fact allow us in 2015 to actually take all of this information and actually as a legislature to be able to actually put together a measure that will have all the accommodations that we've heard and have the best opportunity to cross the T's, dot the I's, ensure that we have the well intentions of what the people want us to do as that. I just feel that this is important. I will also commend the new approach Oregon for what they've done, and I'll be very frank with you. We now have two other measures that are being, one I think circulated, and we have another one that's trying to get their petition certified so they can get circulation. I expect there may be one other one that might be coming out as well. This is an opportunity for us to work with individuals who have come forward with their efforts to ensure that when we have a measure go forward, that we do the best we can for Oregon in this area. Because I agree with what Mr. Smith has said. It is here. We need to deal with it. And if we don't deal with it, it's going to be given to us, and we're going to have a lot of unintended consequences or inability to move forward without having cooperation from the drafters. Now, I again will say, and I have spoken to the individuals with New Approach Oregon, I appreciate what they put together, because to me it is a framework of what we will be working with in the 2015 session. I do believe there's discussions that we need to have as to how the taxation would work, how we're going to ensure that there's money there for public safety, for enforcement, how we're going to deal with the mental health issues, etc. And so from my perspective, having this presentation, I want to thank everyone that has come forward, because it has given us, at least this chair, an opportunity to understand and appreciate the need for us to be working together and ensure that we don't try to put something out so quickly that we're not going to be up in the latest hiccups that may have occurred through this process, knowing that the federal government at this point has a lot of say of what they're going to allow or not allow a state to do. So this is a draft that I wanted to give at the end. I did not want this to become the focus point, because I thought it was very important that we heard from all of the presenters as to their experiences of what they've seen around. So with that, Senator Close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. in the interest of balance and public health, I think it should be pointed out that all of the presenters today indicated they were advocates of this going forward. I think the general public needs a chance to at least come forward to give their opinion. We did have a ballot measure that failed, and I think that's an important component that we get a little bit of balance also from law enforcement if possible. Thank you.
Well, I think we just had some law enforcement perspective already given to us. Representative Barton.
Mr. Chair, I wanted to second your comments regarding the testimony today. All of us on these committees are fairly familiar with these issues. We deal with them quite a bit each session. Nevertheless, I think the discussion today was very thoughtful, very informative. I feel I learned a lot from each panel, and so I wanted to thank you guys, especially those of you who traveled. Thank you.
With that, thank you very much for being here. We look forward to working with all of you in the future as Oregon tries to tackle this issue. With that, we're going to go ahead and close the informational hearing on the legalization of sale of marijuana and open up our next informational hearing. This is going to be a report on the public's, report on speedy trials. And we have a group of presenters, and so Justice Domenech, I understand Peter Gartland is not going to be able to join us because he's ill. Gail Meyer and Aaron Knott, if you all would come forward.
I've been in Milwaukee since 1944.
All right, you beat me because I've only been in 66.
Yeah. Money is against legalization. So you guys feel that same way?
Well, we have mixed feelings, yeah. I think it's happening. I think it's that guy.
Honey, it's bad news. We don't want to do this.
Okay, let's talk more about it.
All right.
Been around too long. I know what's going to happen. Just like that guy said, no matter what you do.
Okay, so for this presentation, I'm going to leave it for the three of you to take the leads as who's going to go first or second or third or however you're going to break it up.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. They said they picked me to go first. I'm Paul Demunis. I'm a professor across the street at Willamette College of Law. One of the classes that I teach is Oregon Criminal Procedure and Practice. That class includes a segment on speedy trial. Mr. Taylor asked me if I might appear here today to give a brief synopsis of the law of speedy trial in this state. Listen closely. I'm here today speaking only for myself, not for Willamette and not for the judicial branch with which I used to serve. Speedy trial in Oregon has two sources of law: statutes enacted by a legislature and Article 1, Section 10 of the Oregon Constitution. I'd like to start with the statutes. We've had speedy trial statutes in Oregon in one form or another since 1864. These statutes had their origins when Oregon judges traveled the so-called circuit, and all the judges needed was a horse and a rented room in each community to hold court. Although the statutes have been amended a few times since 1864, they contain some vestiges of that judicial history. Today, the relevant statutes are ORS 135-747 and ORS 135-750. In 2005, the Oregon Supreme Court undertook a review of those statutes in three cases, concluding that under the statutes, the state is obligated to bring a defendant to trial in a reasonable period of time, and when the state has not done so, the court must dismiss the charge against the defendant unless the state can provide a sufficient reason for delay. If the state does provide a sufficient reason for the unreasonable delay, the court has discretion whether to dismiss the charge or continue the matter for trial. Over the last 150 years, the Supreme Court has referred to the speedy trial statutes as docket clearing statutes or a housekeeping mechanism triggered by the length of time that a particular case has been languishing in the system rather than by the effect of the delay on a particular individual. In other words, these statutes are focused on the administration, the public administration of justice, and they're not necessarily focused on the individuals. As you can readily understand, these statutes have the greatest impact on misdemeanor cases because the statute of limitations are shorter for those lesser crimes. So even though a dismissal of the charge under the statutes is without prejudice, meaning the state can refile the charge, in cases where the delay has exceeded the statute of limitations applicable to the crime, the charge cannot be refiled. Under the Supreme Court case law, the delay has been found to be unreasonable for a variety of reasons. In State v. Johnson, the delay was 21 months between indictment and arraignment. The court concluded that the 21-month delay was unreasonable and that the state's decision not to arraign the defendant for nearly 2 years because he was being held on a murder charge in another county was not a sufficient reason under the statutes for the delay. In State v. Davids, there was 11.5-month delay between indictment and the defendant's arrest. The court concluded that the delay was unreasonable. The state argued that the budgetary constraints that prevented the service of low-priority warrants was a sufficient reason for the delay. However, the state had not offered any evidence to support that in the proceedings below, so the court, there was actually nothing to justify the delay, and the court rejected that argument. Finally, in State v. Adams, there was a 23-month delay between indictment and trial. The court concluded the delay was unreasonable and agreed that with the state that overcrowded dockets could in some circumstances and in some courts be a sufficient reason for delay that might otherwise be unreasonable and justify a dismissal. However, the court rejected that argument in Adams because it concluded that in that case, an overcrowded docket did not justify a 23-month delay, roughly the equivalent of the statute of limitations for that charge. With regard to the statutes, two things seem important to me. All but a few of the states in the country have speedy trial statutes. The purpose of these statutes, including Oregon's, is court administration, or put differently, docket control, to remove cases that are languishing in the court system. The statutes are not focused primarily on the rights of the individual. That's why a defendant does not have to prove any individual prejudice as a result of the delay. Now let me turn to the Constitution. Article 1, Section 10 of the Oregon Constitution provides that justice shall be administered without delay. That provision of the Oregon Constitution had its origins in the Magna Carta. The Oregon Supreme Court has held that the speedy trial provision of Article 1, Section 10 is a mandatory direction to the state to bring the defendant to trial without delay, and that the provision serves the interests of the defendant in obtaining a speedy trial and the interests of the public in the prompt administration of justice. A speedy trial claim asserted by a defendant under Article 1, Section 10 requires a court to examine the length of the delay, the reason for the delay, and any prejudice accruing to the defendant as a result of the delay. The court weighs each of those factors in determining whether a defendant's right to a speedy trial has been violated. Although each of the factors is important, in my own personal view, the question whether a defendant's defense has been impacted will weigh most heavily in the court's calculation. When there has been a reasonable possibility of that kind of prejudice, that is likely to tip the court toward finding a speedy trial violation. Dismissal of the charge is the only remedy permitted under the state constitution for the violation of a defendant's right to a speedy trial. Under the constitutional analysis, it's a factually specific inquiry, and unlike under the statutes, a dismissal under the Constitution must be with prejudice, regardless of the seriousness of the charge. Accordingly, these cases are extremely complicated and can take up a good deal of court time. If the speedy trial statutes are repealed, it will force litigants and courts to engage always in constitutional litigation in each case in which there arguably has been an unreasonable delay in getting to trial. So that's a brief synopsis, as fast as I could go, of the law of speedy trial in this state. Obviously, there are a lot more subtleties to the issue. But it seems to me, in making a change to a statutory practice that has been with us for 150 years is quite significant and ought to require a careful analysis requiring data, not just anecdote, and should involve all segments of the criminal justice system. I would also caution you in listening to all segments of the criminal justice system not to overlook the victim community. There is a link between speedy trials and restorative justice. The longer it takes a defendant to get to trial, the longer a victim waits for restorative justice. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee. My name is Aaron Knott. I'm the legislative director for the Department of Justice. As most of you are aware, at the end of the last legislative session, we adjourned with a sunset having been imposed on statutory speedy trial. So in the interim, the Department of Justice, OCDLA, undertook a state-by-state, 50-state review of statutory speedy trial in addition to the federal system and the recommendations put forward by the Bar Association. I'd like to stop and thank Cameron Dyer, my intern at the Department of Justice, for reading those so that I didn't have to.
If I can just stop you for a second, I know Chief Justice Domenech has another obligation. I want to thank you very much for taking time of your day to make this meeting, and safe travels.
Thank you. Thanks, Chief. So I won't revisit the distinction that was just made, but I wanted to talk to you guys a bit about how these warrants sort of end up in the system, what's happening within the criminal justice system to cause this sort of flood of warrants. So I think it would be helpful to hear a little bit about a sort of typical case. So let's say your car is stolen over the weekend, so and the person who did it is apprehended. So on that Monday, they're in custody, and they're usually presented with what's called an information. That's not an indictment. A grand jury hasn't had time to get together. It's just an information, which is basically a district attorney's prediction of what they think they can charge you with. They have only days to get an indictment. This is a challenge. So for a victim, that usually means, because in property cases, I think it's actually the case in every county in the state, that there are no resources to send an investigator to a victim or witness's door with a subpoena for, say, a stolen car, even though that is a felony and can trigger prison. So the subpoena is mailed. For a victim, that means they get it sometimes 48, sometimes 24 hours before grand jury. If they can't arrange childcare, if they can't get out of work, or if they simply fail to receive the subpoena, they don't appear at that grand jury. That typically triggers a defendant's release if he's being held, because the information that held him has expired. So in that case, usually within a few days, the victim does appear, and the grand jury does consider the case, and they issue an indictment. That indictment goes into the system as a warrant. This is an example of how statutory speedy trial kicks up. The previous speaker characterized this as a housekeeping mechanism for the courts, but interestingly, it reaches back further than that. The timing for statutory speedy trial, when the clock starts running, isn't when a defendant appears in court and is arraigned on an indictment, as it is in some jurisdictions, but not here. It's with the issuance of the warrant following the filing of the indictment. So statutory delay starts well before, in many cases, when that defendant actually makes it into the courtroom. So in my written materials, I've provided a number of different fact patterns that can lead to statutory speedy trial that we've been finding in our inquiry. I'm not going to go into those too much here, but I do want everyone to go to the last page of my materials, if you don't mind doing so. This is the Josephine County Sheriff Office fiscal comparison for 10-11 up to the present. And I call your attention to the line towards the bottom that reads patrol deputies. And I'd ask you to note that in 2010, Josephine County Sheriff had 27 full-time employees. They now have one patrol deputy. This is a force contraction of 96% in a four-year period. And to put some more human details on that, I traveled to Josephine County and I spoke to the sheriff. He's an older gentleman. He typically works by himself. It takes about an hour for him to cross Josephine County with his lights and sirens on. I asked him what he does for backup in a hot call, and he basically said, the state police, if I'm lucky and they're nearby. And I asked him about the service of warrants, and he just shook his head. He said, you know, I serve them if I can. I serve them if I come into contact with the defendant. But I am the only county-level law enforcement for an area the size of Rhode Island. So for statutory speedy trial, this has created some complexity. Because as I said, the amount of time it takes a sheriff or another officer to serve a warrant counts against the state in that calculation. It goes beyond just a housekeeping mechanism for the courts because it extends backwards. So we're seeing some effects. One, in many parts of the state, and I looked at Josephine, I also looked at Curry, I looked at Crook, I looked at Multnomah, and you see some common trends with difficulty keeping up with these warrants. You're just seeing a capacity problem relative to the warrants going out, and in some parts of the state, that capacity problem is so drastic that it's hard to imagine how one sheriff could ever keep up with the county-level warrant obligation. It slows things down. We've also noted within the Department of Justice that this is an amazingly frequent subject of appellate litigation and appellate opinion. So we ran the numbers, and we believe since January 1st of 2012, the appellate division has filed 30 briefs, and the Oregon Court of Appeals has issued 31 opinions addressing, in some way, statutory speedy trial. Now, I know that number doesn't mean much in a vacuum. I'll assure you it's a lot, especially for a statute that's been with us practically since statehood. We estimate that we spend 240 to 400 lawyer hours on this subject per year, which is a lot. Now, the reason for that is that the Oregon statute is unique in one very special way. If you look at the phraseology in the statute, it basically says that the state has a reasonable period of time to bring a defendant to trial. That reasonability language is very, very tricky. On the trial level, it basically doesn't provide anyone with a bright line, any sort of a yes, no. And on the appellate level, it signals to the appellate court that they need to revisit the factual findings that were made by the trial court and determine reasonability. That's causing everyone a significant amount of work. We're also the only state in the union that uses that term. So that's something that we've looked at quite seriously. Another point I wanted to highlight before moving finally into some discussion we've had about possible ways to deal with this is judicial delay. In some of our small counties, you may only have one operative jury room at any given time. And if that judge, or maybe pair of judges, is dealing with docket congestion, that can become systematic fairly quickly. And this is a situation where the prosecutor comes in and says, I'm ready for trial. The defendant comes in and says, I'm ready for trial. The victim comes in and says, I'm ready for trial. And the court says, we're not ready for trial. We don't have anywhere to put you, and we may not be able to put you anywhere for a while. That was the case in Adams. That was a Washington County case, where you saw the court forced into huge delays because that was sort of where they were at in terms of their docket at that time. And I was surprised that it was Washington, because there are much smaller counties with severe budget congestion and a dramatically fewer number of judges. So Gail Meyer and I have met, I'll say, a dozen times trying to come up with some options, and I do have a few to share. I'm not endorsing any at this time. I just want you to have a sense of where the discussion has gone. So first of all, the bill is initially introduced in the full session in 2013, called for a prejudice requirement. The previous speaker talked a little bit about what that was, but it's basically you use the constitutional standard. In essence, that requires a defendant to show that they personally, if you recall, that right attaches to them personally. So they personally suffered an adverse effect. And there's case law on what that means, but examples would be, easy ones would be, a witness dies, physical evidence is lost, you can't put on a defense because of the passage of time. So that is one that we've discussed. Secondly, that term reasonable, is there a substitute for that? Should we consider something more finite, as most states have done? And finite not meaning even necessarily more stringent than the law we have now. The previous speaker didn't highlight this case, but Ms. Meyer and I both believe that statutory speedy trial can be triggered in as little as 11 months under some circumstances, and I do believe that that is the state of the law. That trio of cases sort of define the parameters for statutory speedy trial, but as I noted, there have been 30 or more just this year, so it's a very, very moving target. Next. Excluding that period of pre-arraignment delay, what do you do with these counties that can't serve warrants? Well, at a minimum, 15 other jurisdictions don't start the clock until you actually appear in court on an indictment. You're given a lawyer. You're given a trial date. That's when the clock starts. And the remainder, it varies. For some, it's arrest. For some, it is, as it is with us, with indictment. But this is something that can be moved statutorily. There's no constitutional problem with that. Next, consider the exclusion of judicial delay. This also is done in some other states. If delay is caused not by either party, but simply by the difficulty of the judicial branch, you do not calculate that time. Finally, the state can get out from under statutory speedy trial issues in a pre-arraignment context through the exercise of something called due diligence. Now, due diligence basically means if the state tried to serve a warrant on you and they couldn't for a legitimate reason, then that shouldn't be held against them. An extreme example of that would be they go to your house, they go to your work, they're asking your friends, they're calling your parents. Of course, that's only going to happen on murders, but that's clearly due diligence. The problem with existing definition of due diligence is it requires a uniformed officer with a badge to drive out to your house or your place of work and attempt service on you, which runs into obvious resource limitations. So we've discussed, could a letter be sent? Could a phone call be made? Is there some other avenue for the delivery of service that would maintain the core function of allowing a defendant to know that they were the subject of a warrant if the prosecution wanted to move in that direction without triggering the comparatively significant cost of sending maybe the only sheriff out in the county to that defendant's home? So I am open for questions, and otherwise I will turn it over to you.
One way to get the both presentations, then we'll open up for questions.
Thank you, Chairman Brzozinski, members of the committee, Gail Meyer, on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Aaron and I have been talking at length about this issue. Pretty much everyone does agree that a prompt resolution of criminal allegations is a good ideal. Everyone agrees with that. But this is such a tightly woven system that the adjustment of any one little procedure can have ramifications down the road, and so therefore there's tension in terms of who should be responsible for what kinds of delay is excusable and who should feel the pinch and why. So we've been rattling with these issues, but quite frankly I'm hopeful that we're getting closer. We haven't really been having a data-driven discussion yet. I'm hoping it can get there. We've asked for information from LEDS as to the amount of outstanding warrants per county, because there's 36 counties. All of them have outstanding warrants. And we also want to know the time to trial data from the judicial system per county. What we can tell you anecdotally is a few things. It looks very different in all counties. Some counties have a problem with pre-arraignment warrants out there, but they promptly get you to trial once you're in the door. Other counties are pretty good about serving the warrants, but once you're in the courtroom, you can experience judicial delay. So it looks different everywhere, but we haven't yet gotten mired in that data. I will say, and I think this is an important thing to let the committee know, even in those timber-distressed counties, pretty much what both of us are hearing from my members and from Mr. Knott's queries, on Measure 11 counts, sex crimes, violent personal felonies, the warrants are being served. Even in the distressed counties, they are getting out there. When they get a grand jury indictment and they get a warrant, they are picking up those individuals. The problems where you have outstanding warrants for grand jury indictments that are not being served pretty much resolves around property crimes, drug crimes, and some felony DUIs. So I think that's an important thing for the committee to know. I think there really are three issues before this committee. The first one is this. Is the existing statute that Oregon's had, 135.747, so cumbersome and so inarticulate that it should be repealed? This committee's already decided that. This body's decided that. You've repealed it effective April 1. The purpose of the repeal, though, was to entertain really the second question. Is there utility in having a statutory speedy trial right that's separate and distinct from your constitutional floor? You have state and federal constitutional guarantees. They are personal to the accused. They are the bottom below which no one is allowed to go. So the question for this body is there utility in having a statute independent of those constitutional guarantees? The American Bar Association standards say yes. There's 48 states that have statutes. They would say yes. The purpose of the statute, the American Bar Association says, is threefold. One is to further promote the accused's interest in a speedy trial. Secondly, to protect the public's right to a speedy disposition of a criminal case, including in that is witnesses and victims. The public has a right to expect that if the government has arrested someone, charged someone with a crime, that the government will undertake reasonable efforts to get that person, that allegation, resolved. Third purpose of a statute is to make sure that judicial resources are being used on the rightful cases. If you get some case so old that the reasons for prosecuting really have faded, maybe that's not where the judiciary should be expending its time. So there are three purposes behind a statute. And then third question is, if there's utility in having a statute, then what kind of statutory provisions will optimize the best results? That's the more difficult conversation. The Department of Justice and OCDLA have undertaken a 50-state review of other states' laws. I can tell you that I don't think the other stakeholders who have pitched in this discussion have undertaken a 50-state review. When you're mired in the silo of Oregon practice under 135.747, that's what you know. And I can say this, I will admit this, having undertaken a 50-state review, on perspective now, you can see why existing 135.747 has some inherent flaws. It's the only statute in the nation that uses the phrase, the state shall bring the defendant to trial within a reasonable time. That's aspirational, but it doesn't really say much. So there's been this huge, lengthy layer of appellate gloss superimposed upon it, and it's very cumbersome and burdensome to adjudicate, both at the trial level and on appeal. So we are now, OCDLA is now here to say to this committee, I think Oregon can do better than 135.747, but we also submit there's utility in having a statute in place. So we have OCDLA put out on the table a proposal that initially was shot down, but on further discussion, possibly there's some tweaks to it where we actually can make some movement. And what we're looking for is a statute that will put responsibilities on both parties, the defendant and the state, to exercise responsibility to get into the courtroom door. And so we're modifying a proposal somewhat under a Pennsylvania model, which is a very simple, truncated analysis. From time of filing of the indictment until trial, you have 365 days. Within that time frame, the state shall exercise due diligence to get the defendant to trial. If you need an extension beyond 365 days, you can get it as long as the state has exercised due diligence to get the defendant to trial. So extensions are granted for mental incompetency examinations, the defendant's in custody elsewhere, they can't bring him to trial, there's an out-of-state witness, they need more time. What then, how would this impact those counties that cannot serve grand jury warrants? And this is where I've encouraged Mr. Knott and myself to start thinking outside the box on this, because what does it mean to exercise due diligence if you're in a county like Josephine and you've got one FTE to serve a warrant? We're encouraging an outside the box effort to resolve that. It can be so simple as, have you considered, keep in mind these are mostly property and drug crimes, have you considered sending a letter to the accused at the address they gave you when you last saw them? When you arrested the guy, he gave you an address, either to the citing officer or to the recog officer. The person probably has a driver's license somewhere. Can you send him a letter? Can you do it within a certain time frame? The other thing that we're finding now is that most folks carry a cell phone. They do, and they'll give you the phone number of it. And Multnomah County is finding, just in the pretrial release practice, if they phone these folks the day before court, they get in. If they do the phone call like the dentist does, right? We all get the phone call from the dentist and the eye doctor. If they call them, they get in.
So efforts that really are not, they don't require the police officer on the porch in the uniform tagging you saying, come with me in the car. It's the simple fact of advising the accused. You have a grand jury warrant out. If you care, get in. Correspondingly, the flip side of that is we're prepared to say, and this would be new in Oregon, if the defendant fails to appear, the defendant waives their rights under the statute. So what you then do is you say this. If you abide by the statute, you're going to get the benefit of its protections. If you neglect the statute, you will not. So the state has the burden of at least exercising a modicum of due diligence of informing the accused there's an outstanding grand jury indictment. Here's your phone call. Get in. And correspondingly, the accused has the obligation to show up, and if they don't, they waive their rights under the statute. This is a brand new discussion that Mr. Knott and I have just been having even as recently as today. We haven't fully vetted this, but what we like about it is, I can't speak for Mr. Knott, but I think that there's effort here to make sure that there's a statute in place that is workable, notwithstanding the constraints of some counties. So we're still at it.
All right. Thank you. Okay, first I got Representative Krieger and then Representative Bart.
Gail, I appreciate the fact that you continue to come back to the table and with Aaron. We saw the last two sessions, people doing that in work groups. They finally got to a consensus and got something done. I think it's very, very doable here. And probably Mr. Representative Hicks might say something here, but Josephine County having one deputy, I mean, that's almost impossible. The thing we need to understand about the serving of these warrants, we've got five or six more counties in the next 4 or 5 years that are going to be in the same fiscal situation. Curry County, come the end of June, we don't know what we've got left. So we need to be considering when you're talking about what is the capacity of these counties to even do this with the number of officers they got. And last, Aaron, you used the word older gentleman in referring to the sheriff. There's a couple of legislators up here that might want to, what is that level of older?
No, we don't want to know.
Think. Chair Brzezinski, Representative Krieger, thank you for that question. My understanding is, and Representative Hicks, give me the thumbs up or thumbs down on this, that Sheriff Gilbertson is 63 years old and very, very active.
Yes.
I actually want to comment on your...
I'm 73. I'm not the oldest one up here.
And Representative, it is an adjacent district, so if he does retire, the position may become vacant. But I do want to remark on what you said earlier, because this is an important point.
It is.
One FTE in Josephine County, no matter what solution we come up with here, we are papering over the public safety situation in Southern Oregon. What Gail and I are trying to do is come up with non-fiscally intense solutions for a fiscally driven problem. And I agree.
I just appreciate very much that you're working at it. We want you to be successful.
Thank you, Representative Krieger. And I'll say this, the other party that's not well served by having outstanding warrants are the victims. They've had a victim of a crime, they've reported the crime, they've come in, they've gone to the grand jury, the grand jury's met, they've indicted the guy, the warrant's out there. So what is being done to get the defendant in the door? Again, what we're looking at is if the accused knows of a court date and blows a court date off, OCDLA is prepared to say we're not here to try to protect that person's rights any further than that because they have the Constitution, but they shouldn't be protected by the statute. Correspondingly, we think the state does have an obligation to do something to help the accused understand you're wanted in court. And we think that that serves everybody's interests, the public's, victims, and everybody's. So we're still working on the solution.
Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Gail, I spent actually probably as much time thinking about this bill as any other vote I took of the last general session. At the time when it was proposed in committee, it struck me as not that significant. It was, after all, I think the chief used the words administrative and housekeeping measure that resulted in dismissal without prejudice. I don't think I have grasped kind of the gravity of statutory speedy trial. And so I supported it and was fairly flip. I don't know. I wish I would have thought about it more. The pushback I have received from the criminal defense community since that time has been tremendous, and I will summarize, in fact, more than any other bill of the session, and I'll summarize it as, you don't care about civil liberties, you barbarian. It was roughly something along that.
That's correct.
And so it made me realize that perhaps I had missed something the first time around. As I hear you talk about it today, it seems that OCDLA is saying something very different than what I'm hearing from your members, i.e. that indeed there is a problem with the statute, and that maybe I didn't miss any. I'm now confused.
Okay. Chair Posonsky and Representative Barton, this is a very important point. You're listening to Gail Meyer, who's undertaken a 50-state review. There's 1,400 members in OCDLA. They are still mired in the silo of 135-747. They've been living in this appellate silo the way it's been forever. And they do feel as though this is a trampling on a very important procedural due process protection. But they are lacking in the perspective of what that 50-state review presents, which is perspective that there is some aspects of our existing statute that's burdensome, bloated, cumbersome, inarticulate. And when you look at the other states, they have a set time frame. The ABA standards suggest a set time frame, included, excluded. So I'm speaking with authority from my committee.
Follow up, please.
But the members may swipe you.
Indeed, that's actually I do respect, and this is going to sound hostile, I don't mean it that way. I haven't done a 50-state review. I do respect your enlightened perspective. However, to the extent your perspective is such, and all of your membership feels very much differently, how are we supposed to make a deal here with you on behalf of your members when none of them will respect that deal?
All right, so we're going to let that one stand there for a little bit.
I'll work with you on that.
Please.
All right. Senator Close.
I'll make it quick, Mr. Chair. I know we're getting close to the time. Aaron, I'm concerned about the counties, you know, keeping them safe. I'm wondering if we went to a statute like that, if then the defendant could turn around and sue the county for under civil rights?
Chair Przanski, Senator Close, again, there's the distinction between statutory speedy trial and constitutional speedy trial matters here. Statutory speedy trial, it's been around for hundreds of years. It doesn't attach to the defendant. It's not their rights. So if we were to pass a statute that in some way constrained constitutional speedy trial, we would be sued appropriately for that. I think we both agree, and the chief would agree too, that that's not what we're doing here. Statutory speedy trial originated in having the court have an ability to make the parties go to trial, and that's most of what it is, and even most of what it still purports to be. It's just our position that it's bloated beyond that. So I think we'd be safe from civil liability.
Thank you.
All right, Senator Cruz.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to the concept of we've done due diligence by a mailing to what we think is the best address we have. That's going to stand?
Do you want to answer that?
Senator Przanski and Senator Cruz.
Let me answer that question. It can't if we put it in the statute and says that these are the ways that we'll do it.
Okay.
So we can define what due diligence is. The reason I'm kind of looking at the clock, I know some members need to be on the road to get back to their districts. We have two more presentations, so if there's not other questions, I want the two to come up and just kind of give us a report where they're at, make sure they know we're still watching and waiting. We know that they're holding hands and working together, and that's good.
Mr. Chair, I'd also like to point out that not everybody has cell phones in my part of the world.
Or that they work.
Yeah. Phone number.
Yeah. So I think at this point, thank you all very much for the update. Really appreciate it. And please go forward, continue your discussions and deliberations. With that, we're going to go ahead and close the report on speedy trial. And Vice Chair Krieger is going to take over the next presentation.
Okay, we'll have an informational hearing open. I want to get a report from the work group on filing fees for appeals from local land use decisions. Jonathan Matten, Steve McCoy, Aaron Doyle, and Mike Benedict.
Thank you, Chair Krieger and members of the committee. My name is Jonathan Manson. I'm testifying today on behalf of Central Oregon Land Watch. It's late in the Friday. I know that we've had a lot of great testimony already today, so I'll try to be as brief as possible, but I just want to say thank you so much for your continued attention to this issue. It's one that we've brought before the legislature twice now and been working in a work group for the last few months. I want to just kind of update you on the background of the problem here. We're certainly happy to continue working in the work group to try to find a solution. I have to be honest with you and say that I don't feel very optimistic that we're going to be able to come to you and say that we all agree on one. And so we're hoping for some legislative leadership, and I'd like to just kind of explain the problem in a quick few minutes here and give you an update as to where we are. This is about appeal fees at the local government level, the county and city level. To initiate a land use application, the applicant will submit an application to a city or county, and that application is heard at a hearings officer or planning commission level. By statute, the amount that is charged for that hearing or hearings officer or planning commission is $250. That's the cap that's on the fee for that hearing. The site is in my testimony. To appeal that decision to the full board of county commissioners or to the city councilors, the statutory limit is not defined as an amount, but instead says the fee shall be reasonable and no more than the average cost of such appeals. So I'm talking about kind of things in three steps. The first step is the hearings officer level, and there's a limit of $250 in statute as to what that fee can be to hear that. The second step is for the county commission level, and for that step, it's current law allows for the actual cost of the proceeding to be charged as the fee up front. So in your written materials that I just gave you, there's a the second section of that is a database spreadsheet that shows you the amount that each county in the state charges for that second step. You'll see that it varies widely. Most of them are around, you know, $400. There's some $800, $600. But on occasion, we have a few outlier counties that are charging as much in Klamath County as $11,000 for that appeal fee. So if you are a citizen trying to access your own county commission for that hearing step, you're being asked to pay, and sometimes up to that very large amount. In Deschutes County, it is, and sometimes over $5,000. So what we're asking you here is for, in the interest of access to justice on behalf of citizens, to close the loophole at that second step and put a cap in for what the appeal fee should be for the full board of county commissioners or city council level. The proposal that we support would cap it at $1,000 and then also allow for an extra $500 to be spent for the cost of written transcripts and materials. Justification for that amount, again, the step one fee is $250. This is the step two we're talking about. If the decision at step two is appealed to LUBA, the Land Use Board of Appeals, the appeal fee there is $400. So the amount of a cap at the step two level of $1,000 plus another $500 for transcript costs is substantially more than what the other two steps are. So we think that's very reasonable. Frankly, I think there's a problem with doing a pay-to-play system when you're acting as a quasi-judicial function at the county level. As a policy choice, I would like to see the fee be much lower than even $1,000, because I think when you are just saying that we're going to set a fee at such a level that folks with resources can afford to access their county government, folks without resources cannot, then we have a serious problem. And there's no intent here to try to put our impoverished counties in a harsher situation than they're already in. We just heard from the last hearing how bad rough things are for some of the counties out there. And this proposal would not actually cause financial harm to the counties. The counties will tell you a different story, obviously. They don't want to have a cap on it. But here's why we don't think that this proposal would actually negatively impact counties. Number one, again, it's not all counties that are doing this. It's only the outliers. Number two, these cases don't happen very often at all. It's a very small number of times that you would have this happen. And number three, in the event that these appeals do happen, what we're learning from the cities and counties is that the reason the costs are so high is that you're paying for the work of the hearings officer or the commission at the step one level. So those costs have already been paid for in the application fee, usually. You also are having cities and counties hire attorneys at that step two level when outside attorneys are unnecessary at that point because the hearings officer can present the information that they've already come to. The applicant has an attorney at that point. And so it's not an efficient use of public dollars that are limited to have that. Those expenses anyway. And then finally, the most important reason it wouldn't actually hurt the counties and cities is that they have all discretion under current law to just not have the hearing. If they think this is going to be too expensive for them to undertake, they can adopt the ruling of the Planning Commission, the step one, and just move it on. And the parties can then, if they want to go litigate at LUBA, they can. But each county has the absolute discretion, our city, to determine what the fiscal impact of this proposal would be on themselves. And it's fast. It's Friday afternoon, and I'm more than happy to try to answer any questions. And thank you again for all your attention to this.
All right. Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would you be, if we're going to set caps like this, would you be willing to consider geographic limitations on standing?
Senator Cruz and Chair Prozanski, I think I understand what you're referring to. I don't necessarily see how they are connected. We're talking, I think you're talking about access as far as who has standing at LUBA.
It would be a land use decision in Baker County to have somebody from Columbia County appeal where they really have no vested interest unless they have land there. I mean, that's the sort of standing I'm talking about, is to limit standing to those who actually could be affected.
Senator Cruz and Chair Prozanski and Chair Krieger, members of the committee. Again, it's a completely unrelated conversation, I think, but the reason why some of the standing laws are in place now that allow for folks who participate at the local level to have standing as compared to how far away you are to have standing is because oftentimes these land use decisions impact folks that live very, very far away. And so our standing laws right now do protect citizen access. You're talking about once we get to LUBA, because if you participate at the local level, then that's what gives you access to the court, not how much money you've got, for example, how much you can afford, which is what this problem we're trying to face is addressing now.
Who's going to be next here? Please identify yourself. Go ahead.
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, I am Steve McCoy representing 1000 Friends of Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on this important issue. In the previous panel, we heard Chief Justice Emeritus Domínguez talking about Article 1, Section 10 of the Oregon Constitution and how there was infrastructure underneath it, statutory infrastructure underneath it. That's exactly what we're talking about here as well. Article 1, Section 10 of the Oregon Constitution states in part that justice shall be administered openly and without purchase. In 1873, soon after the Constitution was passed, the Supreme Court eloquently interpreted this clause to mean that the attendant or incidental expenses of litigation in the nature of costs and disbursements, so exactly what we're talking about here, shall not be so exorbitant and onerous as to virtually close the doors of courts of justice to those who may have occasion to enter there. In other words, that the rights of the poor man to redress his grievances shall be equally respected with those of the rich, and that equal and exact justice shall be dealt out alike to all. And this spirit is in fact, embodied in the very first goal of Oregon's land use program. Goal one is to develop a citizen involvement program that ensures the opportunity for citizens to be involved in all phases of the planning process. The ability for citizens to participate in appeals, well, that is a phase of the planning process. And that is a bedrock principle of our land use program. So exhausting all local appeals is a prerequisite to getting to LUBA. Getting to LUBA is a prerequisite to actually entrance to the courts, since LUBA is actually in the administrative branch and not in the judicial branch. So what we're talking about here is local appeal fees. If you can't exhaust local remedies, so if you can't afford local appeal fees, you cannot get to LUBA and you cannot get to the courts. So what we're talking about here, as Jonathan said, is only for rather complex decisions. The local appeal fees are capped at $250 for easier types of decisions, for ministerial decisions, for things that don't involve a permit, for example, also. So for these complex decisions, we've seen many, many instances where in a limited number of counties, but multiple times, that local appeal fees have been in the thousands of dollars. So we're only talking about large projects here, subdivisions, big box retail, other commercial activities, decisions regarding destination resorts, non-farm uses on rural lands, those sorts of things. So often the appealing party is a neighboring parent or business owner or farmer who's worried about this use being incompatible with their family, their neighborhood, their business, or their farm. So if, for example, an objectionable business is moving in next door to a family's apartment, a large local appeal fee would close the doors of justice to them. Currently, the law requires that the local appeal fee must be reasonable and no more than the actual or average cost, as Jonathan said. However, the reasonable prong hasn't been reached in a case in a long time. LUBA has remanded on whether appeal fees were the actual or average costs. However, they have not reached the reasonableness prong. Virtually, at this point, reading it out of the law. We feel like it's time for the legislature to breathe new life into the reasonableness requirement that's in state law, and it will require legislative action. It may sound like a burden to cash-strap local governments. However, we're not proposing capping appeal fees for decisions that allow political considerations for the local government. So this is only when the local government is acting in a quasi-judicial, like a judge, time. So for legislative decisions, this appeal fee would not apply. So it's only when they're acting like a court does, applying the facts to the law. In these cases, the local government is not even required to take appeals. Under current law, they can allow appeals to either go directly to LUBA. They can also, and some local governments do this, they can have it so that the decision of the Planning Commission, for example, does not become final for some weeks, for 21 days, for example. And then the local government can catch it before it gets to LUBA if they want to catch it. And in that case, charging these gross appeal fees is certainly an issue. So politics are not supposed to be a factor in these decisions because they are quasi-judicial decisions. So the political body is not required to get involved at all. If despite these facts, local governments choose to take the appeals, it only follows the appeal fees should be capped at a reasonable amount. Thank you.
Great.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Mike Benedict. I'm the planning director for Hood River County. I'm here representing Hood River County and also the Association of Oregon Planning Directors. I apologize for not being as eloquent as some of your other speakers. I'm a simple planning director. Appeal fees are determined by statute the same way we determine our permit fees, by an average cost. What all counties have done is undertaken some process to determine what that average cost is. Appeals are real cost. We have lots of overtime, we have lawyer fees, we have mailings, we have newspaper ads. Hood River County charges $2,033 for an appeal to Board of County Commissioners. That does not cover our cost. We do subsidize both permit fees and appeal fees by general fund. But you shouldn't think of this appeal fee by itself. If one fee is capped, that means other fees are going to have to be raised in order to compensate. Counties, planning departments do not have any room at all to absorb losses in revenue or, in this case, just planning funds. Put that in perspective, 3 years ago, or about closer to 5 years ago, I was a planning director with five planners and three support staff. Now I'm a community development director with two planners, one support staff, and I also have taken on building codes, economic development, IT, and veteran services all under my hat. That's how much we're contracting at the county level, and Hood River County is relatively healthy. As you go east of us to Sherman, Gillum, Wheeler counties, you can see one person planning departments. In one case, I believe it's Wheeler, the planning director there is also the assessor. So we're spread pretty thin. As the former speaker said, in many cases, it's not a huge burden to us, but any burden is starting to get huge. The amount of money that we would lose, for example, Jackson County, probably within the last 6-7 years, had 45 appeals to LUBA in 1 year. That's a significant cost if you cap their appeal fees. The rest of us, like Hood River County, I've probably had a dozen appeals to my Board of County Commissioners in the years. The former speaker said this doesn't affect the political determinations by the Planning Commission. Well, the Planning Commission legislative decisions are not decisions. They are simply recommendations because Planning Commissions don't make legislative decisions. There was a comment made about the poor farmer next to the Walmart. I don't think any of us have ever experienced a Walmart application where we didn't have a thousand citizens banding together to hire a lawyer and really fight the Walmart. This is true in just about all cases. I'm very familiar with the Destination Resort on the north side of Mount Hood and how much money that took us, like for six nights of hearings and renting a high school in order to even begin to address the situation. Capping fees is a fees are a county decision. There should not be a statewide resolution. If you have a couple outlier counties, take care of them. As one county commissioner was famously quoted, if you've seen one Oregon county, you've seen one Oregon county. Each one of us is different. We would really, if the legislature would like to look at the fee issue, we'd very much like to look at removing all caps, including the $250 ones, because that is probably the one that kills us the most. Thank you.
Representative Garrett, you had a question?
Thank you. Yeah, just on that last point, you suggested if there's a couple counties that are charging excessive fees, deal with them. How would you propose we do that, if not through a kind of capping mechanism like this?
I would actually retract a little bit, because I believe that if you're in a county where you're charging an extravagant amount of money for a fee, that we have a system to deal with that, and that's the ballot box. I think if the citizens of that county are very upset, then they'll let their county commissioners know at the next election cycle.
Okay. Anything further, committee? I guess we're going to let you have something.
Chair Krieger, Chair Przanski, members of the committee, for the record, Erin Doyle with the League of Oregon Cities. We are also invested in this. We do, as cities, go through a public process of setting our fees. We traditionally put these into either our land use development ordinances or a fee schedule that comes up before a city council and has the opportunity for citizens to weigh in on what it is we deem our fees to be appropriate for each city. And each city makes the decision as to how much of an appeal they choose to subsidize. Some set their fees relatively low $250 for even these complicated decisions, and one or two have set it at cost, which varies greatly from appeal to appeal. But most of our cities don't recoup the costs that they spend preparing for these appeals. And part of these costs, it's not as simple, you get the record, you read the record, you take a couple of seconds of testimony and you make a decision on the same issues that were raised at the original level. This appeal can introduce any number of new issues that have to be researched so that we make sure we make legal decisions, because if we just are based on our gut feeling, we're going to get overturned because we have, like you, citizens serving as our city councilors and our county commissioners. These are not everyone on a city councilor is a lawyer, a planner, an accountant, and all of the other things that come to land use decision making. So we need our staffs to support our decisions, and these decisions aren't on the original issues that maybe were raised the first level, like at the Planning Commission or before the hearings officer. It can be, you know, one or two new issues. It can be 35 new issues, and that takes a lot of time and preparation from staff to come up to speed on what these new issues are. It takes legal research to do that, and we can't depend upon a hearings officer who is a trained attorney to do that work for us at the appeal level, because that's like having a trial judge serve as the clerk to the appeals court. And that's an inappropriate use of the hearings officer. That's why we have city attorneys or county attorneys, and that's why we sometimes hire out, because we can't afford to keep them on staff. We don't seek out the most expensive and biggest name. We seek out a cost-sensible alternative for the city. As far as taking the politics out of the decision, because it's a quasi-judicial decision, there is a requirement that we define our terms. If we don't, LUBA will do it for us. And I think that all of our city councils, as much as you would like to have your legislative intention put on the record, they want their intention of what their codes mean, what the words within the codes intended as part of that decision when LUBA takes it up on appeal. And if just hearing from my cities, there's no lack of appeals that are going on now. As they set their fees, they're seeing an increasing number of appeals every year. So there's not a lack of access to our city councils on controversial decisions like these. I think that taking all of those things into account, at this point, I think it's up to the local level to determine what's the appropriate thing for their community as far as how much we subsidize of these costs, because when we charge $250, it's still going to cost us maybe $3,000 or $20,000 to hear that appeal, just at the local level. And then we have to defend ourselves in front of LUBA, which we get no reciprocal payment for. We cover that cost. We cover the cost of preparing the record, which can be 2,500 pages long. I just keep throwing thousands out there. I apologize. So for those reasons, we would look at things such as increased transparency as a possibility for maybe reining in what appears to be a cost that's out of control or a fee that's out of control, forcing, you know, some sort of transparency in those areas where we charge at costs or average costs, and make sure that citizens are aware of how we arrive at those numbers and why the appeals fees are set at what they are set at, and to continue to allow LUBA to take the appropriate review of our fees. And if it's in the statute already, then they can check us on our reasonableness. And for those reasons, we're trying to participate in a process, but it's very difficult for us to see a cap that is as low as $1,000 and takes away the potential for covering more of what can cost up to $35,000.
Okay. Mr. Turner, do you have a question or comment?
Chair, members of the committee, maybe this was covered when I was out of the room tracking down something different, but one thing, we've had four meetings of the work group, at least four, and one thing that we did discuss is the original $250 fee was last raised in 1995. So even adjusted for inflation, that would be up to around $300. So that could possibly have changed, balance off some of the costs. The other thing we talked about was, well, why not allow the parties the right to go directly to LUBA? If it's going to cost them a very significant filing fee, if they've had a hearing before a hearings officer or the Planning Commission, which specializes in this, and they're going to have to spend that much more money, why not just take it directly to LUBA? And then we got into discussions about whether we should give due deference or not to the decision made at the local level. But we never came to any resolution on this, nor have we come to a resolution, as you can see, on filing fees. But those are other issues that are out there and other considerations that could be considered.
Okay. Anything further?
Yes.
Sir Bobanski.
I'm wondering if, Aaron, if you could give us some type of listing what the cost is at, for each of the cities, because you've given a range that seems like it could be some cities being close to $35,000.
Chair Krieger, Chair Brzezinski, it very much depends upon the type of appeal you're looking at, and that we did a brief survey, and obviously not every city gets back to me every time I ask them a question. But
can you just provide whatever you have?
I will provide that to you, and I'm working on creating a list of what exactly our cost drivers are, and I was going to provide that to the working group, and I will provide that to you as well.
Thank you. To us as a panel.
Yes.
Yeah. Sir Denbrough.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Also, I'm curious to know just how frequent these the counties or the local jurisdictions are having to deal with issues like this. Could there be some sort of matrix provided? Is that something that the work group has, Dave?
Chair Krieger, Senator Denbrough, I can provide that as well from the view numbers that I have. It very much depends upon the city and how much development's going on at the time, because if you look at, for example, in Bend, pre-2008, you're seeing like two a month. Post-2008, there's a significant drop-off. So the numbers that I have are for the past 10 years, so you can average it all out. But some cities see one in 10 years. Bend has seen 82.
Mr. Chair, let me just add really quickly to that, because that's kind of somewhat deceiving about what's happening in Central Oregon. So Central Oregon Land Watch is the primary organization there that's bringing appeals. In 29 years as an organization, there's been 22 appeals to LUPA from Central Oregon Land Watch. So we're hearing a lot of numbers here. But in 29 years, we've got 22 appeals to LUPA. It's less than one a year.
Okay. Well, I'll add another one. Crook Estate in Curry County, $790,000 the Crook family has put out on a project that has been praised by every environmental group there is, including the Audubon Society, simply because one or two individuals take it upon themselves they don't want a golf course. And for that family to absorb that amount of money, and they are getting to be senior citizens too, been working for this for their family, they've had that property since 1853, I think is ludicrous that everybody has access to continue to take them to court. Anything further, committee? Questions?
Nope.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll close the informational hearing on this subject and open one on the opinion of from Legislative Council at SJR 34 from the 2013 session. Dan Gilbert.
That's my angry color.
I love getting the last word in.
You always do.
Straight to the point.
Move it.
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dan Gilbert, and I'm an attorney at Legislative Council. I was asked to come here today to briefly discuss SJR 34, which is a proposed amendment to the Oregon Constitution that the Legislative Assembly referred to the voters during the 2013 regular session. I also prepared a written opinion for Chair Brzezinski on this issue. As Chair Brzezinski has waived confidentiality for members of the panel, that opinion is being passed out to you now.
What it means to the whole world.
So the purpose of SJR 34 is to allow individuals to serve as an Oregon state judge and to simultaneously be either one employed by the Oregon National Guard or to teach at an Oregon public university. There's no issue with respect to the National Guard portion of this. However, we believe that there is a problem with respect to the portion of SJR 34 that would permit judges to teach at Oregon's public universities. This portion of SJR 34 does not actually refer to public universities, but instead refers to being employed by the State Board of Higher Education for the purpose of teaching. This is problematic because in 2013, the Legislative Assembly also passed Senate Bill 270, which will remove three of Oregon's public universities from the control of the State Board of Higher Education, effective July 1st, 2014, by the establishment of independent governing boards. Senate Bill 270 further envisions the very real possibility that some, if not all, of the remaining four public universities will follow down this path in the relatively near future. The transitional language of Senate Bill 270 is likely sufficient to ensure that any judge employed by the State Board of Higher Education at the time an institutional governing board is created may continue their involvement with the university. However, we don't believe that it would allow for future judges to teach at these universities after a board has been established, and given the relevant time frames, it also means that in its current form, SJR 34 would probably not allow any judge to ever teach at the three universities scheduled to receive the governing board July 1st, 2014. The solution for this, while the law is slightly unsettled, we strongly believe that the Legislative Assembly has the authority to revise SJR 34 to meet its intended goals and to instruct the Secretary of State to disregard SJR 34 and to solely refer the revised version to the voters.
Gosh, Senator Probansky, how did you miss this?
So, this is
actually, I was going to ask the same question. We finally got this.
I mean, it's taken many, let's say, sessions to get this through. And I have to say, I do believe, if I remember correctly, and we may have been, I don't think we were actually in this room, but if I'm not, if I remember correctly, Senator Denbrough, as a representative, actually asked me the question as to whether this was going to be a problem.
Yeah.
And of course, relying on the information I had, I said, oh no, it won't. And then after, of course, we got it passed, then some people start looking at it. And Senator, I wish I had listened to you at that moment and we would have taken care of it. But I also think that there's another piece in the opinion. It's the third paragraph on the first page, which also I think that I'd like to have Dan to go ahead and just kind of go over that, because I think there's a issue that we need to also update the Constitution that was modified, if I remember correctly, in the late 50s.
Yeah, so one of the aspects of the Oregon Constitution is that there are several references to the State Board of Higher Education. And one of them, which is in this, it is Article 15, Section 8 of the Constitution, actually refers, is what permits an individual to be an employee of the State Board of Higher Education or of any of the public universities in Oregon and to simultaneously serve as a member in the Legislative Assembly. We would recommend at least considering if SJR 34 is ultimately revised, it may be worth trying to amend this section as well. Senate Bill 270 had a companion bill, House Bill 3120, which had slightly better language in terms of legislative intent with respect to the constitutional provisions. I think that should also be inserted into possibly as a technical fix during the February session, inserted in to make it very clear that for Senate Bill 270 purposes as well, that the intent is to make it so that there is a continuation of any entity that any person who would have been employed by the State Board of Higher Education previously but is now employed by a public university would still be considered a member of the State Board of Higher Education, employed by the State Board of Higher Education. That said, that is just legislative intent, which would matter, but it cannot necessarily bind a court.
All right. So, colleagues, so this is one of those things that I just think that we need to address, because we don't want to send something to the voters that is basically moot and actually is not going to be effective. But I think the other catch that LC and I think Dan and whoever else in LC that came up with this stuff on the modification to the Constitution that the voters passed back, I think it was 58, because we've looked at this issue before in some other context, that needs to be updated as well. So,
I guess I want to make sure that we're covering private institutions as well, if indeed that's applicable.
It's not a problem. Right now, they can serve because the issue is, like, for the judicial branch.
Government to government.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Right, the separation of powers of the three branches.
But I would also suggest that we try to be as generic as possible because the terms we're using are subject to change. So,
as we see.
I mean, if we can, however generic we can be to accomplish the purpose.
You're going to work on that then, Senator, between now and February, and get us a bill?
Yes, that's one of the bills
this
I'll be
in. This will be an easy one if we can get it right.
Yeah. Senator Denver, would you have something?
Yes, I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm glad you caught this and that we have a path to fix it. And on the technical issue that you raised, Dan, there are some technical amendments that are going to be proposed in the February session to 270 and 3120, you know, just a sort of Christmas tree of little technical changes. Perhaps this could be addressed there.
Chair Krieger, Chair Pruszanski, Senator Denver. Absolutely. It largely can. Constitutional amendments would of course have to go through this.
If I could further, you know, one question that I've always had about this is, you know, in 2011 we passed Senate Bill 242, which moved the Oregon University system from being a state agency to being a public corporation, essentially. And, you know, so I've always wondered whether this provision applied to them after that happened. Because, you know, the prohibition is on, you know, somebody who is an employee mm-hmm. of the state, as it were. But it seems to me that after 242, employees of the State Board of Higher Education, of OUS, are kind of like community college faculty or, you know, faculty who are not part of a state entity. So, you know, I'm just wondering if that's... True.
I think it's better to remove all ambiguities, period.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Well, that's why we have these attorneys at legislative council to figure these things out.
I mean, you may be right, but why
do you guys have anything on it?
I have one other.
Sir.
And Dan, this is, I think, based on the catch you caught regarding the current stat constitution under Article 15, Section 8. I believe we as a legislature have the authority to actually do in one bill a referral that would separate these questions out. I mean, what I would think, the caution is we can't ask them to do this together in one because, or would we, I'm not sure if we have the authority to have that single subject overridden because of how we do it, or if we need to have two separate ones in one bill that would be referred as independent questions to the voters.
Chair Pruszanski, that's an interesting question. I think it would probably depend on what the fix was, whether it could actually fit under one subject. I would not be surprised if it would require to.
And so
it's serving.
Well, I mean, I could see where, you know, someone could challenge it and say, well, yeah, I want the judges to do this, but I don't want people employed or just the university to be able to do it. And so I believe we can actually put two in one bill that goes out as separate, but if you can check in on that.
Chair Pruszanski, I will get back to you with a certain answer on that.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you. I think that's all we have on that. We'll close the informational hearing on SJR 34. I think we're finished for the day, aren't we?
And the Senate's adjourned for the day. Thanks, you all. Safe travels. Happy holidays.
Chris, I'm Gail. Yeah, man. Have well.